I'm going to call to order the meeting for the Grover Beach City Council. It is Monday, November 19, 2018. Would you all please stand with us for a moment of silence for all of the victims and their loved ones and the all of the fires that are raging in the state? Thank you. Please remain standing for our flag salute. Please follow me. Place your hand over your heart. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. When you're ready, roll call, please.
Councilmember Nichols?
Here.
Councilmember Peterson?
Here.
Councilmember Shaw?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Lee?
Here.
And Mayor Scholes?
Present. Thank you, Wendy. At this point, the council will review the order of the agenda as presented by staff and determine if we want to make any changes. Do any members of the council wish to change the order of the agenda?
I would just make a recommendation, if we could, that we move the Mentone Basin Improvement item up before or just after the consent calendar, which I guess would be item just before item 13. I think, is that correct?
Yeah, I think that works. Anyone else? Okay, someone would like to make a motion?
Make a motion that we proceed with the agenda as amended.
Second.
Okay, there's a motion, there's a second. If there's no additional discussion, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? None. Motion carries. So we will move forward with the agenda. We're just going to, looks like we're swapping the order of items 13 and 14. I believe there are some extra agendas on the table at the back of the room. So why don't we get started? Let's move on to our ceremonial calendar. We do not have any items this evening. We're going to move into public communications. This is an opportunity for any member of the community to address the council for a period not to exceed 3 minutes total on any item of interest within the jurisdiction of this council. Council will listen to all communications. However, in compliance with the Brown Act, we cannot act on any items that are not on the agenda. So this is for any items that are not on the agenda. When we get to an agenda item, I will give you time to speak on that item. So I do have several speaker request forms, so I'm just going to call them out, and I'll call out two so you can be ready. So the first one is Mildreen Kirby, followed by Les Henderson.
My name is Mildreen Kirby. I live at 1825 Brighton Avenue, Grover Beach. I'm very concerned about the accidents that we keep having on our intersection of Brighton and Oak Park. I don't know what the answer is to it, but we have many pedestrians that have had near collisions. We've had one that just recently that was a collision, and something needs to be done because they're speeding, and I feel almost threatened every time I go to pull into my driveway from people coming off of that intersection. I just wanted to call it to your attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Les Henderson. Les will be followed by Marcia B.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Les Henderson. I live at 332 North Oak Park Boulevard in Grover Beach. I've been there as a homeowner for 30 years. I'm here today to ask for some help. We are in a situation that it's life and death. Life and death. And I'm referring to our intersection at the corner of Oak Park and Brighton. In the last 3 months, we have had so many accidents, I can't tell you. In the last 2.5 weeks, we've had 3 major accidents with major damage to people and one death, from what I was told. What is going on is basically We have got a situation that is out of control. Three primary aspects of the problem. And I know what the problem is. I just don't know the solution. And that's why I'm here for you folks. But if we don't do something, and we have been discussing this matter of Oak Park for 30 years that I know. But now we have to do something because lives are in danger. The first thing that we have as a problem is speed. People from Saratoga to Grand on both ways are speeding. The speed limit there is 30 miles an hour. People are exceeding 40 miles an hour. And it is a situation where our police department are doing the best they can, but they can't be there 24/7. And since I live right on the corner, I'm watching all this stuff. So it's not the police department. The police are trying to do the best they can with the resources. But it's not working. The police are not making any difference in the speed. Speed is increasing and increasing. We have two lights with showing people how fast they're going on both sides of my street. They don't work. People are not paying attention to them. And actually, the street sign with the miles per hour on it on my side of the street hasn't worked 80% of the time. It's not working now. I have called several times, three or four times, asking it to be fixed. They've come out and tried to fix it, but it goes out again. So it doesn't work. So that's the first thing. The speed is out of control. People are really, truly speeding. And when I have sat there and watched this speed monitor, it goes to about 40, and then it goes off and says, you're going too fast, slow down. But these people are going very, very fast. The second problem we have is people making a left-hand turn on Oak Park, going down from Saratoga to Grand, making a left-hand turn on Brighton. Okay, what is happening there? We have got a situation where people are coming down the street. And if you know Oak Park, which I'm sure you all know, it's on a hill. So people that are up at Saratoga that are coming down, even though they're trying to maintain the speed, their car keeps rolling and it goes faster and faster. The people that are starting from Grand and going up to Newport and Saratoga are gunning it because it's uphill. So people are really, really traveling. But two-thirds of all the accidents that are happening in this intersection are people making a left-hand turn onto Brighton. What is happening is people are coming down and rear-ending these people, okay? And also these people making left-hand turns are turning into the upcoming traffic. They're trying to beat stopping. So as they're coming down the hill at 30, 35 miles an hour or 40 miles an hour, they're not even stopping. They're cutting into a lane that is the people coming into Brighton that are wanting to make a turn. So it's a hazard there. There's been accidents there. Like I said, in 2.5 weeks, I've had three major accidents. And in June, we had another major accident involving two cars that were destroyed and ended up on your sidewalks and in front of my house. And it took out my mailbox, but it could have been a lot worse. So the accidents are just growing and growing because people are going too fast, not paying attention, and it's really a hazard. The third avenue of the problem is the pedestrians. We have all types of pedestrians crossing that, from the senior citizens, which I fall in that category, and I take my life into my hands every time I try to cross the street, from children to ladies with baby carriages, to mom and pops, to council members, to whoever. All sorts of people are crossing that street. And a week from yesterday, at about 7:30 to 8 o'clock p.m., there was a gentleman that was crossing Oak Park, going towards the beach. And he got halfway across the street and was in the medium divider for the two lanes, the two yellow paint. And three young people came down Oak Park speeding and hit him. And I saw the footage of it. I saw the actual person being hit with this automobile. Because my neighbor across the street who works for CMC has a security cameras all over his house for protection. But he also shows that intersection. So everything that I'm saying tonight can be proven if you want to look at that footage. But he has this footage of this gentleman crossing the street and getting hit. And I'm telling you, folks, if you're even considering what I'm saying, I suggest you go look at that video. It'll change your life to see a man get killed. And the thing that bothered me, I guess, the most was he was laying in the ground on the street, and six or seven cars went by, and nobody stopped. Wow. Nobody stopped. That's not us. So, like I said when I first began, this is a matter of life and death. If you don't do something, somebody else is going to get killed. Somebody else is going to get hurt. And we're having so many accidents there. And like I said, I don't know the solution. I really don't. But you have to do something. And probably anything that you do will affect my property in a negative way. And I understand that. But, you know, it's time that we start looking after people. So I thank you.
Thank you, Lass, for those comments. Marsha B. followed by Susie. Susie Reed, is Susie here yet? Okay.
Yes, I'm Marsha, and I've been a resident of Grover Beach for 27 years, and I've attended over 200 city council meetings and community meetings, and I've been a community volunteer, so I think I know the city fairly well. In 2002, the people in my neighborhood on the 200 block of South 9th, were surprised by the people's kitchen moving in without a notice, no public hearing, no permit, and no explanation from the city council, city mayor, city manager, excuse me, or the city attorney. No response at all. In 2003, the neighbors and the merchants in the what's called the business corridor were kind of perplexed as to how could this happen with no permit, no response from the city at all. And especially when the location of the People's Kitchen is in a high-density R3 residential area, where it is illegal to have such a service 365 days a year. And we did our best to rectify health regulations. The health department came out and found some violations, etc. But when we came to the city council and expressed our concerns that this was an illegal operation, we understand that people are homeless and hungry. I'm not saying they don't deserve it. At the time, we had a recovery center half a block away. We have the Five Cities Women's Council food bank, and we had a PCP house and a lady selling drugs in the corner on the corner to the elementary school kids and the bus driver also, as you know, that story. Anyway, I think everybody's aware that of Megan's Law and Jessica's Law and the Amber Alert and all of these laws that were passed by our legislators to protect children, especially under 14 years of age. Originally, the stipulation was a minimum of 2,000 feet requirement that convicted child molesters, according to their degree of their crime and the length of their probation, were required to honor that 2,000 foot border from schools and parks where especially young children under 14 or under 10 would congregate. Well, this has been a concern of ours for 15 years, the 15 and a half years that we've had the People's Kitchen 20 feet from our front doors. A certified home inspector took one of those wheelie measurement things that they use and measured the number of feet from the property at 946 Rockaway, which is where the People's Kitchen operates. And it's 366 feet away from the elementary school, where the majority of the children are under 10 years old. We were promised by the same mayor who sits before me right now, we were promised in 2003 that we would only have to have the People's Kitchen in our neighborhood for 5 years. When we questioned it, and I have come here every single year before city council and gone to community meetings and stated, you know, when will that 5 years be up? It's been 10 years, 12 years, 15, now we're going on almost 16 years. And got no response at all. This is a big concern, and so now that we know that 366 feet separates a congregation of possible child offenders, sexual predators, we want this removed immediately. And prior to the invasion in our neighborhood of 80 to 100 people seeking assistance for food, for a hot meal at the People's Kitchen. There was an operation here on 7th Street at 177 South 8th Street. This offers many more amenities than we in, on either the Rockaway intersection of 800, 900, and 1,000 addresses on Rockaway Avenue. And the 200 and 100 block of South 9th Street, we do not have a paved road. We also do not have curbs, gutters, and sidewalks. This is also an extreme concern because many of the people who use the People's Kitchen walk right down the middle of the street. Now, there are six restaurants in the business corridor. And their food delivery trucks come right down Grand, going down West Grand, going west. After their deliveries, they turn left. And I understand that it is not a legal truck route. And they go speeding down our street where people are pushing their children in strollers and some family members in wheelchairs. And other people just walking down the middle of the street because it's the only real pavement. We don't really have pavement, but it's the best we can do. And that's very, very dangerous, too. And that is an accident waiting to happen. So anyway, I'm just saying that the best possible place for a People's Kitchen, and we thought about this for 10 years, is to go back to 177 South 8th Street, where the people that need help might more easily get help from City Hall and the police department. Also, the police department, the officers will not be confused as to where the People's Kitchen actually is located. I've called a number of times, and the officers really want to get there when there's a problem, but they can't figure out where it is because one of the buildings with a cross on it faces north, their entrance faces north, toward the other building with a cross on it that faces, you know, that it's a half a block away that faces west. And there's huge confusion that is it the food bank? Is it the People's Kitchen? Is it just the people camping out? Is it just people that are mentally disturbed? What's the deal? And it would be immensely, I think, a convenience not only to the police department but to the people in our community who have to live in this area to get faster service and to feel a little more safe. Also, I did take a census, and there are 15 children living at the 200 South 9th Street addresses who are under age 10. And I think this is kind of a violation. You know, I understand that And I know my time is up, but if you just give me 30 more seconds.
I've been giving you, you're good.
Okay, thank you.
Wanted you.
There's 15 children under the age of 10 living on in our neighborhood, and also I don't know how many hundreds of children go to school at the elementary school, but most of them are under 10. And we're just concerned that this is already a highly impacted population. Over 65 people live on our street, and then there's a whole bunch of houses on Rockaway. And this really is not safe. And I know I moan and groan and complain and fill out forms, but there's a lot of frustration that nothing has been done, nothing. And now with expanded services of shower facilities, the mobile shower facilities can easily park in City Hall parking lot and be well monitored. People will feel safer. It's got to happen. We just have to have it happen. You know, 366 feet is just not a good idea. I think now the law, the Grover Beach Police lowered the stipulation, which was approved by the city, to lower the requirement from 2,000 to either 5,000 or, 2,000 to 1,000 or 500 feet. I'm not arguing with that. They have their reasons. I know there was a lawsuit for that, okay. And the city lost. But I'm not complaining about that. I'm just saying it's okay. 366 feet is not acceptable.
Okay, Marsha, I need you to wrap. I have
Thank you,
others,
that's it.
But thank you. Susie?
Hi, my name is Susie Reed. I live at 332 North Oak Park in Grover. We're getting more and more concerned about the used car lot of called Oak Park Boulevard between Brighton and the church. Every day, any time of the day, you will find half a dozen or more cars up for sale. I'm not saying it's not their right to do it. I have no idea if there's any parking regulations against it. I know that they will be there for some time and not get ticketed, so I'm assuming there is no regulation. One of the biggest concerns is we can't get our street swept because there's always cars there. And so I was hoping at the very least maybe some signage could be approved to prevent parking during street sweeping, say that three times fast, street sweeping days and hours so we could at least get the street cleaned. As it is now, my husband is the in-house Grover Beach street cleaner. He's the one that keeps our neighborhood looking nice, but since we're paying somebody to sweep, it would be nice if they could get the job done. And it's, again, kind of tacky to have day in, day out, all these cars up for sale, and RVs, and who knows what else. So anything that could be discussed and approved would be appreciated.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Reed. I see someone moving with a blue slip. Is that for public comment? Can you guys just...
Oh.
Okay. Sandra Darby, yeah. Followed by Sue. Sandra, come on up.
Make it sweet. I live in Grover Beach, and I do have a concern about moving the homeless kitchen across the street, and I think it would be better. I've listened to Marsha, and really, she's too close to the kids, yeah. Really. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sue, come on up.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. I'm here to address two things. First of all, on a positive note, I'd like to ask the City Council if they'd be willing to work on a butt can project to get cigarette butts put in a place where they're not in our gutters and in our yards. I think it was a week ago today, I picked up 18 cigarette butts. No, excuse me, it was last Wednesday, 18 cigarette butts after the Narcotics Anonymous meeting at the church building there on Rockaway and 9th. And talked to Pastor Todd about it, and he's going to address it. But I think in one evening to pick up, or then, you know, the day after, pick up 19 butts is a little phenomenal. And usually when we're cleaning our gutters, we collect a lot and put them in the trash can where they belong. So anyway, there are grants available, and I'd be happy to work with the council. This is something that I mentioned to Miriam prior to the election, but I knew that it was a busy time for all of you, and I didn't want to pursue it then. And then the second note are the three city trees in that parking lot. Sorry about that. Could have sworn I had that turned off. The city trees have disrupted the sidewalk, and they leave those big round pods from the flowers. So walking into the polling place to vote, I rolled my ankle on one of the pods, and I don't know what the city's policy is on trimming those trees. I did speak with Pastor Todd today about it, and he also mentioned that he, walking into the parking lot the other day, rolled his ankle. So due to the fact that we do have a lot of people that come to the food assistance program, as well as that building being constantly used, I think it might be to the city's benefit to address a little bit of tree pruning there, just so there's no potential lawsuit looking at them for someone having damage done to their person or a vehicle. We went through this in Morro Bay back in the 90s, and finally they reduced the size of those trees. But I just think it's something that you might want to take into consideration. And have a happy Thanksgiving, everyone.
Thank you. Is there anyone else?
Donnie Whitesong, 1660 Brighton. I've been gone 4 months, and back in the Midwest where it rains, and some days it rains for 8-9 inches, and they mow the yards 7 days a week and at night. I couldn't believe it. It just made me so good. But when I walked in, this young lady back here, she fooled me, because I'm old, but she's still young. But we came here about the same time to Grover City, and I couldn't believe it when they talked about Oak Park. How many times have I been here and talked about that? Now, the doctor had told me a few years ago to walk across, go down to my son on the East Arroyo, but I can't get across. These cars won't let me walk across there. And then you had this young man tell me, oh, why don't you walk up to Saratoga and come back? 85 years old? Yeah. Why don't I do that? I drove across country. That's the 25th time I've gone across. But if you ever get to Wichita, Kansas, and that's where your chief of police used to hide and walk around, that is number one spot. And my grandson's been there several years, but I've been there 6 years. And I just marvel at that place. I wish I was 60. Because I'd move back there in a second. Those people are smart and intelligent, but they have common sense. That's all you need. Now, I've talked about this water. So I come home, the avocado trees are dead. And she gets on the TV and says, vote for me. What have you done? I've talked about all this stuff, and what have you done? You know, name one. But anyway, I'm sick and tired of seeing on TV how to save water. Because on Arkansas, the Mississippi, and Ohio, I've said that hundreds of times, reverse osmosis. This is our sixth year of drought. And my had a roundup, and my son had two truck and trailer loads of hay. Because there's nothing for them to eat. That gets old. And it takes a lot of money. And if you had that reverse osmosis, you might save a few homes that's burned up in Santa Barbara or elsewhere. But they don't understand Trump came out here and, oh, we need to clear the forest. What we used to have 60 years ago, 50 years ago, 70 years, was cattle. And the cattle mowed down the natural habitat. We didn't have fires up until a few years ago because cattle disintegrated. Nobody could afford to raise them anymore. But I've been in it, and I'm still in it, and I'll be in it today. I'd go down. But you need to get that water turned around. There is no, you know, you're contradicting yourself when you put an ad in there and say, save water, when you're letting millions of gallons going into the ocean. Explain that to me, would you? I don't understand.
Thank you, John. Is there anyone else? Wait, you want to come up?
Sure, I would like to. Thank you. First off, congratulations to everybody that was reelected. And I know that the people have a complaint about the food place over here. But just to assume that there are child molesters just going there is pretty, that's not a very good idea. That's making accusations. That's unbelievable. I know a lot of the homeless people in town. There may be some there. But if we assume that everybody was something, then we'd probably all be in jail. That's what I have to say about that. And as far as Oak Park, they're right. And I've done 40 down the street, not paying attention. It's downhill. You have to ride your brakes all the way, or you kind of space it a little bit, and you're going too fast. I've seen cars stop there and had to get into the other lane for the same reason. It is a dangerous intersection, but you all know that. I think Miriam commented on putting a crosswalk up there or something. Maybe it's time to think about that. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Wayne. So with that, I have no more speaker request forms. I'm going to close the public communication and bring it back to the council. I do want a couple of things, and we typically would wait to the end of the agenda to have this conversation, but, you know, seeing some new faces here and hearing passionate comments, I think, to be responsive leaders, I don't want to wait to the end of this meeting. I would say that with respect to Oak Park and Brighton, I know that this issue has been brought up, and I'll acknowledge Mr. Weissong's been bringing this up. I think we've done warrant studies in the past, and the results were that were basically didn't meet the warrants that talked about traffic signals or stop signs. But, you know, I think one of the quickest ways to kill creativity, or one of the worst crutches, to say we did that already. I think based on Les's comments and Mildreen's comments tonight, that it probably is time to take another look at that intersection and see how we can address it. I know that when we talked about improving streets, that we're going to have smooth streets and people are going to be racing down, whether it's a flat street or a street that's a hill like Oak Park. We know that's an issue, and so perhaps we should take another look at it. I don't know if anyone else wants to weigh in on that.
I'd definitely be supportive of bringing a discussion back before us. So once again, I know we've had several conversations, but in light of the comments tonight, it's kind of time again to bring it forward and see what can be done in an expeditious fashion.
Yes, I would like to discuss it again. The studies didn't help us very much in telling us what to do, but we need some new ideas.
Agreed.
Everyone?
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. So the second thing is, I know Marcia brought up People's Kitchen, and I want to make sure that we always try to give people accurate information. When she talked about 2003, 2004, when this issue first came up at that location, I think this council was very good about saying, while we know People's Kitchen is a worthy endeavor, that the folks who live there should not be cast in a negative light, because we are concerned about quality of life in those situations. I would also say that there was a time period in which People's Kitchen had moved I know that they had moved to, I want to say it was Long Branch and South 16th Street on county property. And I know for a fact they moved to where when Shouts of Grace was on 7th and Grand, because I spoke with Ms. Erler. We identified that as a location, and they were there for many years when Shouts of Grace Church was there. So they haven't been at the same location for 15 years. I will say I think they've been back for, what, a couple of years now, or maybe less than 2 years, and I understand that we've been having conversations with them about use permit to try and go through the proper vetting process. I've had numerous conversations with the pastor there, and two things that kind of complicate this issue becomes churches are typically, from a land use standpoint, guided by federal law. And the pastor was very much aware of that. But secondary effects are something that this council and this community should be weighing in on. And so I know there's been ongoing dialogue to try and bring them in and go through that proper vetting process. And then finally, I'll just say that it's a noble cause. That location is probably not the best location, and I say this, and I'm just going to say, I know Betsy for many years, she was a supporter, and all the volunteers are doing great work, and so I'm sure that if people hear my comments tonight, they say I'm not for People's Kitchen. That's not true. I'm for People's Kitchen. I just think there's potentially other locations that could be more suitable, and we've tried over the years, and I'm sure the new council and others, and I plan on staying involved, because I think there is some discussion about how we can have this very needed service in our community and hopefully minimize the impacts on our community. So this is close to my, this is typically not what I do at a council meeting, or we don't do, but I feel that given the comments made tonight, the sincerity of the comments tonight, looking for real answers, warrants some discussion early rather than waiting until everyone goes home. So I'm going to see if any other council members have any comments they'd like to make.
I believe I recall reading that the Planning Commission will be considering a use permit for the showers at their next meeting. I'm trying to remember exactly what date that would be. Is that next Wednesday?
Actually, the commission would be considering the use permit for the entire operation, including the shower operation, at their January meeting, January 9th.
Okay, January.
Okay, and thank you for bringing that up.
And that's the second Wednesday in January. Okay.
Mary?
Just as the person who sits on our Homeless Services Oversight Committee, I think it's always a slippery slope to say, well, this doesn't belong here, and this doesn't belong here, and this doesn't belong here. We're a town of 2.5 square miles. I really appreciated Mr. Embry's comment. I don't think being poor and needing lunch equates to being a sexual predator. And just because I hear this all the time in trying to place services for the homeless, Megan's Law says a sexual predator, and that means anyone. And I read a lot of background reports in my day. That means anyone should not come within 1,000 or 2,000 square feet of a school. The onus is not on a church or the South County Regional Center or anybody to check IDs. The onus is on the person. And I think you'd be surprised in the places you're already going that already have sexual predators. And I only say that because we are looking to get significant grant money to this area to provide actual housing for people and actual services. And if we continue to say that nothing can be near me and nothing can be appropriate, we'll stay how we are now. So I would like us to stay away from that. I support the People's Kitchen seeing the process through, but I'm making no promises that that's an inappropriate spot.
Okay.
I wholeheartedly agree with what Miriam has just said. I work at the Grover Beach Community Library, and as everyone knows, that is a hangout for the homeless. And it is pitiful to see this group of people, and they are usually a group of regulars. They come there in the morning, and they ride their bikes in, and they sit under the gazebo
for a little bit of shelter, or they lay out in the sunshine, whichever weather is permitting. They have nowhere else to go but our public park. At lunchtime, boom, they're gone over to people's kitchen. At 1:30, they're back in the park, and they are not creating any disturbance. Yeah, there's a little bit of trash around, but no more than an active park would normally have. We have to find ways to get them off the streets permanently by helping them learn to get back into society.
So let me just conclude, and then we need to move on. We have a long agenda tonight. Is I certainly wasn't saying buying into the, you know, not near me. I think what I said is that a more suitable location, and I know that Merriam-U is our wrap. It sounds like I know there's some discussion about other potential locations in the city of Grover Beach that could be a solution. So I would just encourage everyone to continue working together. But I also want to let the folks who live in that community know that I understand your concerns and your issues, and that it is incumbent on all of us to take everybody's needs into consideration. And yeah, that means the folks who live there. So I'm going to get off my soapbox, and I think that perhaps we can have staff come back and give, maybe if there's an interest from this, to come back and give an update on where we are with not just the People's Kitchen, but with providing homeless and transient services. I think that would be a worthwhile endeavor, and if there are any potential long-term solutions out there, whether it is some of the things that the committee is working on and how we can all work together to resolve this. Okay.
So with that last thought in mind, though, it may be prudent to see how the Planning Commission discussion proceeds to see if, depending upon what action is taken or not taken on the use permit, whether it comes before us on appeal or is just a regular course of action, it might be an opportune time to combine that discussion if the item's going before the Planning Commission as early as January.
Okay, very good. All right, let's move on to our consent agenda. This is, and I did want to thank everyone who came here and made comments tonight. I appreciate your civil tone. That's why we live in a great country where we can come and express ourselves passionately and do it in a respectful manner. And I just always want to acknowledge folks when they do those sort of things. So thank you. Okay. So we're going to move to our consent agenda. This is where the council will take a group of items, then they're considered as routine items. We have a long consent agenda tonight. Isn't that right, City Manager? I am not going to...
That's correct. We're a busy city.
We're busy. So I'm not going to read every one of them. If you have the agenda, it's items 1 through... My goodness, is that 12? Yeah. So let me see if there's any members of the council that would like to pull any item from consent or if they have any questions on a consent item.
I have some questions on the transient occupancy tax ordinance.
Okay.
And I have a question on 12, which is the acceptance of the street rehab and repair project.
Okay. Debbie, you want to ask your question?
Sure. I noticed that on the ballot, it states that we'll provide funding for maintaining fire and police services, and it will apply to hotel and other visitor-serving accommodations. And on the ordinance, it only talks about hotels, motels. So I'm wondering if that incongruency could present an issue for us.
Council member, I think I'd have to go back and look at the ordinance again, but hotels are pretty broadly defined within the existing ordinance, and the only thing, obviously, in the transient occupancy tax that we changed was just the percentage related to what was defined in 10602. But we'll go back and I'll take a look at it again and review the ordinance to determine whether my recollection was that definition was fairly broad. But if it's not, we can come back with a cleanup.
And so would that be something we could do at the second reading if need be?
Yes, that would be possible. that we could take that and add that. But quite frankly, since you're not changing the amount of the tax, you can do it at any time.
Okay. And I had one other question on that, which I'm now... Oh, it also... And actually, this may be the next one, but they're related somewhat. There was discussion... It was confusing to me whether these amendments provide the city with the authority to go after all taxes collected, or is it just to go after fining or enforcing the TOT and the business tax, business license tax, or the new name for it?
These ordinances would primarily relate to the city's enforcement related to the TOT in regards to the TOT ordinance and the BTC and related to the business tax certificate. Having said that, the city has police power authority in the event that there's an obligation in our ordinances for a citizen to pay any tax that's defined within our ordinance. To the extent that it's not paid, we would have fundamental police power authorities to go after and enforce that ordinance, whether it's specifically defined within our ordinance or not.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Mayor Pro Tem?
Sure. And I'll apologize to the city manager and the city engineer for not asking this question in advance. So with regards to the improvements that we're being asked to accept this evening, I had several members of the public come forward to me and say that the ADA ramps, some of them they thought were not in compliance with current standards that had just been built. And I just wanted to make sure that our third-party inspectors or our in-house staff had reviewed them and are certifying those, so that if there is a concern in the future that either the city is covered or from a liability standpoint, or that if it is determined that they're not compliant, that it's done within the one-year guarantee time period.
So to answer your question, Public Works Director, City Engineer Greg Ray, to answer your question, the designs were reviewed. Every corner was designed within the parameters of actually Caltrans standards, which, as you know, the state architect has blessed the Caltrans standards as meeting ADA requirements. So we believe that they all fall within the guidelines of those requirements to the extent that they can possibly conform. But if there are certain ramps that you have, you know, particular locations that you're aware of that I should be considering, we can certainly go back and take another look at them.
Okay. And so obviously the design is done in accordance with that, but our inspectors reviewed the construction and did the inspections on the ramps as well. So I don't have the locations in front of me this evening, but I can provide those to you.
Yeah, if that's something you could provide, that'd be great. But yes, absolutely. Every single ramp is inspected. Slopes are measured. Every single detail is checked before they're approved.
Okay. And so, but if there was something found in accordance, not constructed in accordance with the guidelines, we do have the guarantee period of which
we can
still acknowledge and get that corrected.
Yeah, we'd have really two layers of remedies. You know, one would be if it was a construction defect, it would be certainly a remedy that we could approach with the contractor over a period of a year warranty. And if it's a design defect, then we certainly have a warranty and indemnity with the design engineer. So,
okay.
Okay, so I just want to make sure I'm clear what your intent is. Are you, I don't know if we needed to pull this item, have more discussion, or...
And I was going to say, with those answers, I'm okay leaving it on the consent calendar,
okay.
Realizing we've got enough... assurances and the one-year guarantee period to be able to remedy if something is found to be in need of correction.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Mr. Ray. I don't have any speaker request forms from the community. Is there anyone that would like to address any item that's on, or have any questions on any items that's on the consent agenda? Seeing no one come forward.
I had questions on the business tax also.
Oh, okay.
I forgot
sorry.
To say that. My apologies. I'm wondering if I didn't see anywhere in there where it addressed home occupancy. And I know historically we have required people who have businesses based in their homes to get a business license. So I wanted to make sure that we were covering that too.
We did. If you look at section 10,200 in our definition, subparagraph B related to business floor space, we define specifically, for instance, I believe it reads, for purposes of defining business floor space of any business operated out of a personal residence, square footage tax shall be based on the amount of square footage used for the business as designated in the home occupation permit application.
Okay.
So we require both the requirement of getting a home occupation permit, and then also this particular ordinance would impose upon them that tax.
Thank you. I must have missed that. And then I know that because the cannabis businesses are paying an additional cannabis tax, they have been exempted. Are there other businesses that pay a tax to the city to be licensed? And are they exempted?
Well, first of all, the only cannabis businesses that are exempted are those within the jurisdictional boundaries of the city because they are subject to our tax. Mm-hmm. Those that are outside who are coming in and doing business, such as deliveries and so forth, are subject to this tax.
Oh, okay. Didn't know that. Well, and that really wasn't my question. But I didn't know that. Thank you.
But sorry.
My question was, as I recall, we licensed taxis to do business in the city, or we certainly, I think we used to. Do we license? In other words, the cannabis businesses are paying a separate license, so they're exempted from this business license requirement. I just want to make sure that we're being consistent with any other businesses that are paying to be licensed in the city, that they're not being double taxed.
I'm not aware of any, actually.
I'll have to look at the police chief about, or Gala, regarding other businesses like a taxi medallion service, but I think in general, again, the policy decision was that the cannabis businesses, because there is a substantial regulatory fee upwards of $15,000 for the largest businesses and the cannabis tax that's assessed on gross receipts, the decision was to exempt them from this particular BTC requirement because of the other fees and taxes that they're
I'm not disputing that. I'm just wanting to make sure we're consistent if there are other businesses that are paying for a license.
Gayla Chapman, Administrative Services Director. The taxi companies do pay a separate taxi permit in order to operate within the city.
Are there any other businesses that pay a separate tax? The gambling one? Or gambling,
they're under a separate ordinance also.
And so they pay a license to the city also?
They pay a fee based on the car per car table, I believe, is how it's set.
And liquor licenses, do they pay? That's paid to the state.
That's paid to the state.
Okay. So my concern is that we be consistent across the board. So if the other parties are having to pay a large licensing fee, as it were, then it would seem that that's inconsistent with allowing the cannabis businesses off the hook but not allowing the other businesses.
I believe we are being consistent.
Gayla, are they absolutely taxes or are they regulatory? And the reason why I ask that is cannabis or cannabis companies within the city pay two fees, basically.
Correct.
A fee and a tax.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
They pay the tax, the BTC tax, not the BTC tax, but they pay the cannabis tax. And then on top of that, they pay yearly for an annual regulatory fee.
Correct.
That fee is not a tax. That fee is for the processing cost associated with the city to run and administer our programs related to this industry. So therefore, I guess my question is, it's not necessarily double taxation to charge taxi companies a regulatory fee as we do with cannabis, and then on top of that, the BTC. So is that more akin of what we're talking about?
I would say that you are correct with that statement, that yes, it's the cannabis businesses have the regulatory fee, which varies per business based on the type of business that it is, and it's in order to cover the costs of all of the cannabis regulations that we have within the city.
Our cost of administering the programs and those regulations,
yes,
such as inspections and those kinds of things.
Yes.
So to sum it up, what we're saying is that the cannabis businesses are paying a regulatory fee in addition to a cannabis tax.
Correct.
And essentially that's what the taxi drivers and the card table operators are doing the same. They're paying a regulatory fee. The fees that they're being charged right now are regulatory,
right,
rather than tax.
Correct.
Okay. All righty. then I'm happy. I didn't want to have to come back and amend it later. Thank you.
Yeah, Mayor Tim.
I just had one quick follow-up. I thought I heard our city attorney say that the outside cannabis businesses are not subject or are
That's
subject
right.
to this.
No.
In the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7th whereas in the resolution, it I think it states the opposite. So we'll just need to update that and make sure it's consistent in the ordinance. So it starts, commercial cannabis businesses located within or outside of the city will be exempt from this chapter.
That's a good catch. I apologize for that. Yeah, we'll have to change that in the whereas. But actually, within the body of the ordinance itself, the body of the ordinances has them subject to those who are outside coming into the city would then be subject to this tax.
Okay, that's
and we will change that whereas provision.
Okay, so with that, someone want to make a motion on the consent agenda?
I'll move that we with that the change that was just the correction that was just suggested that we accept the consent agenda as written.
Second.
Okay, there's a motion and a second. Any additional discussion on the motion only? Okay, seeing none. Maybe have a roll call vote, please. Okay.
Councilmember Peterson?
Yes.
Councilmember Nichols?
Yes.
Councilmember Shaw?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Lee?
Yes.
And Mayor Schultz?
Yes. Motion carries 5-0. Okay, we are now going to move to item 14, which is the Mentone Basin Park improvements, because as you recall, we switched the order of 13 and 14 earlier. So, City Manager, are you going to introduce this item?
Yes, I can. While our team is getting set up, I'll just acknowledge that there's been a lot of work being done by the staff, by the commission, by the neighborhood, taking part in this process, and we're delighted to bring this before you tonight. And this is an example of the council policy process in delegating a park improvement project to the commission to really jump in and do some good legwork, get analysis, look at options, and then make a recommendation back to the city council. And we're pleased to do that this evening with our team, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Petker and Ms. Wiggin to give the presentation.
Okay.
Good evening, Honorable Mayor, City Council members. Actually, I was going to do that exact same introduction, so thank you to the City Manager and with the input of also City staff, including the City Manager, and the being able to bring this item forward to the City Council this evening. Just want to turn this on. Introduce the Mentone Basin Park. It is a 4-acre park. It's bounded by South 14th, South 16th, Mentone, and Trouville Avenues in the city, south side of the city. A majority of the park serves as a stormwater drainage basin. And this report is going to focus on the park in three areas. The sports area, which is the basketball and tennis courts, restrooms and drinking fountain area, the drainage basin, which is the majority of the park, and the former Carolyn House site. For your visual overview, here is the overview of the park. The corner of the Carolyn lot is 6,500 square feet. It is on the southwest corner in this visual. It is undeveloped. The Carolyn House was demolished due to deterioration beyond repair. So at this time, I'm going to turn it over to Erin, and she's going to give you the CIP descriptions.
Thank you. So the adopted CIP program includes a Mentone Basin project. This project is allocated for the sports area, and there is currently $70,000 allocated for that work. So there were four large ficus trees that caused significant damage to those walkways over there and then the planters, and they were removed earlier this year as the first part of the CIP project. So staff did consider doing kind of a simple repair to try and address some of that damage, but it was very significant damage, and the walkways no longer meet current ADA anyway. So the city hired a landscape architectural firm to design improvements in the sports area over there and to work on the ADA requirements as well. So this visual here kind of just shows some of the sidewalk uplifting. It's damaged the courts over there. The trees did come down, and they were blocking the lighting as well for the courts. The planter boxes are ruined from some of the root damage over there, and then there are benches that are on those planter boxes that have deteriorated as well. So this is a conceptual plan that our landscape architect developed, and it shows improving the ADA walkways, improving sidewalk repairs, adding a picnic table, adding some hardscape, redoing some of the landscape there. So just walk you through some of the scope items there. Again, the ADA improvements. And the estimated cost of construction for this work is about $90,000. So again, as I mentioned, we have $70,000 budgeted in the adopted CIP. The design costs are about 25% of that cost. So staff is recommending phasing construction of these items. The first fiscal year, this fiscal year, for $50,000, and then next fiscal year, the remaining $40,000. Moving on to the drainage basin. So this has been used as a sports field with the lights and the backstop over there. But it's been closed for about 6 years for due to maintenance costs and water conservation efforts. A soccer team did use the fields briefly, and they paid for the maintenance and improvements for a short period of time, but they haven't been used in quite some time. So staff reached out to other cities with similar basins to see what their maintenance plans are and what their annual costs look like. They do close the basins for 2 weeks after a rainfall to let the basin drain completely, and then the crews go and remove all the debris and restore the damaged areas. Their basins are used for organized sports, so their routine maintenance, their weekly costs average about $1,000 a week. Significant watering is required, and then mowing and irrigation monitoring, and then field repairs since they get used so heavily. They do have to close the basins for 2 months every year, I think in May and June, and that's when they do their big annual maintenance, and they do major irrigation repairs, field leveling, fertilizing, reseeding, and aerating. So that annual maintenance costs around $20,000. But staff is estimating that annual maintenance costs would be less for just general use of that basin, not for sports use. We're also estimating that the initial cost to open the basin just for general use would be about $45,000, and then $85,000 for field use. And a lot of that cost is for ADA improvements. Moving on to the last area here, the Carolyn House site down on the southwest corner. The landscape architect did prepare a conceptual design here. It's a little hard to see, but they proposed kind of providing connectivity between the sports area and the Carolyn House site, and then adding a barbecue and some picnic tables and some seating over on that site. So that conceptual plan was taken to the Parks and Recs and Beautification Commission, and Kathy can add more.
So before we took it to the commission, one of the highlights of the report is that we were recommended by the commission to send out a community neighborhood survey, and that was our opportunity for the public outreach in the local neighborhood. So we sent out 215 addresses seeking input on the park, and we wanted to learn what they were currently using the park for, what they wanted to see in new improvements, and what they thought of the current condition. So we had a 13% response rate, which is considered successful in mail-in surveys. 40% of the respondents stated that they visit the park daily, which was good to know. And the ones who did not attend visit the park was basically because it was not kid-friendly, they did not feel safe, and the park was unkempt. In terms of the park condition, they rated as 34% rated the park as good or excellent, 55% is fair, and 10% is poor. and their most popular uses, which would be understandable considering how big it is, was walking, jogging, basketball, and tennis, respectively. And then they stated they would like to see more outdoor exercise equipment and picnic tables and barbecues and playground equipment for young children. The highlights of the commission's recommendation when they did review it was the fact that they did want to prioritize the health and safety issues, and they wanted to make sure that the walkways and the ADA access was the first priority in repairs and accessibility. And this is consistent with what was budgeted in the current CIP. And also, the recommendation from the commission was to open up the gate to the basin and just have it open for general use, make it safe enough for that. In terms of the former Carolyn House location, that they had recommended removing the parking lot access for cars, as they felt confident that the street parking was sufficient for the park area. They also recommended the small playground be located in that general vicinity, and with coordination with Firma, they stated that the parking lot could stay if needed and that the small playground could be fenced if it ended up being in the location of the former Carolyn House. So the commission also wanted the council to be aware that they would recommend a fitness trail with exercise equipment that would go around the perimeter of the park, and to have, you know, maybe 10 exercise stations where people could have their own circuit and go around the whole area. Perimeter of the park is approximately a quarter of a mile, so that can make a great exercise routine. And then also recommended to redesign the Trouville Avenue side to be parallel parking instead of perpendicular, and to include some wide enough area to have a sidewalk or decomposed granite path, which there currently is not. Turn it back to Aaron for fiscal impact.
So again, as I mentioned, the current adopted CIP has $70,000 allocated for the sports area work. The design costs are about $18,000, and construction costs are estimated to be about $90,000. So for the sports area, staff is recommending considering phasing the project and doing $50,000 worth of improvements this fiscal year and then $40,000 next fiscal year. For the basin work, the estimated cost to renovate that basin is about $45,000 for general use, and then annual costs are estimated to be about $35,000. Now for organized use and to make the sports fields, that initial cost estimate is about $85,000, and then annual maintenance costs are about $70,000. And then lastly, for the Carolyn House site, the improvements as shown in the conceptual site plan with the hardscape and additional picnic areas are estimated to be about $45,000. And then staff has not prepared a cost estimate to do a toddler play area in that corner over there. So again, the adopted CIP does not include sufficient funding for all of these recommended improvements, but pending direction, staff could return to council with funding options as part of the mid-year budget review and even next year's budget development process. That concludes that.
So ladies, may I ask very politely, I see in our packet, Firma put together these beautiful landscape drawings, and I didn't see one on the, is there a way to get those on the screen so the community can see what is being proposed? So can you kind of walk us through that and then the other two?
Sure.
You know, they say a picture's worth 1,000 words, and so we got pictures,
absolutely.
So we don't want 3,000 words. Pictures would be great.
Repair here. Yeah, so that existing ramp isn't ADA compliant, so the ADA compliance would be on the other side of the park, Kathy, over here. Yeah, and then the significant sidewalk repairs are closer to the courts.
And that's along South 14th Street, correct?
Correct. Yeah. Sorry, okay. Thank you. Then the right now it's currently showing to retain the planters and repair those damages.
Mm-hmm.
And then the brown are some seating benches that could be repaired. The wooden benches that are attached there now are kind of deteriorated. And then there's the additional hardscape and a gathering place, right? Yeah. Thank you.
So that would be new. That's where the Carolyn.
Correct.
The location where Carolyn House was, correct?
No, that's.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So this is the parking lot.
Uh huh.
Existing.
Okay.
This is the proposed new, and this is an area where the playground equipment could go here or here.
Okay. And what would you do in the interim? Would we leave it, or would it be something planted there until council could go through the process of identifying a design for that equipment in that location?
Well, in the interim, right now it is currently being used as sort of a laydown area for our mulch, but that will be gone pretty soon here.
Anybody need some mulch at home? Anyone watching?
Don't take it. We need it. We have a plan for it.
Oh, you do? Oh, oops.
So.
All right. And then there were other graphics. Is there, can we?
Actually, before we leave this slide, if you don't mind. So this slide represents the currently programmed CIP project.
Sure. So, and this is the sports area. Yes. So the sports area is, you know, the picnic tables, the restroom area, and then the courts.
Okay. Thanks.
The other conceptual area is here. Now, this is just the corner for the Carolyn House site.
Okay.
And again, the conceptual plan that was taken to the Parks and Recs and Beautification Commission showed making more of a connectivity between the sites, adding some hardscape, making that continuous there, and then adding some barbecue and picnic tables.
Yeah. Up there.
Okay. And then was there that was just showing a planting plan. You might as well.
Yep.
Can you show the community that?
This is right here, the new planting plan here.
So I think you have a planting plan for that entire length along South 4th Street.
Yeah, I didn't include that in the presentation here. So
I would expect that from an engineer. I'm like, not a park and rec person. All right. I don't know if we have a way. Okay. So I want to get clarification. So there was just some discussion regarding the existing perpendicular parking on Trueville. And there was a discussion or an idea that was floated was going to parallel parking, which would allow expanded use or the wider trails. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, exactly. Essentially to make it so that people could actually walk on that side of the street because there is actually no walking area. It literally is a very short section of the sidewalk. And then it butts up into a curb, and then that's the perpendicular parking segments. So there's like maybe 25 or 30 parking spaces, but obviously some would be eliminated when we go to parallel, if that's what the recommendation, and it would allow the area to be wider for access. Okay. And as a temporary, we could do decomposed granite until we get funding for sidewalks. But that was a recommendation from the commission, and also to be able to add in the stations for fitness if we continue that around.
Okay.
And perhaps more appropriate in our parking discussion. If that idea was floated, how utilized is that parking? If it's underutilized, then perhaps the parallel parking becomes an appropriate discussion. But if it's overutilized, obviously in this photo it's underutilized, but that might be a question that perhaps our parking consultant can share with us either in this item or the next item or when we get to that discussion.
Let me see if there's any other questions of council members.
Here.
Yeah. Barbara?
Yeah. Continuing the parking issue, if we were to have to sponsor an event such as dog trials in the basin, would there be sufficient parking for... because I think a lot of people involved with dog training and that sort of stuff, plus just neighborhood wanting to watch it, would there be adequate parking around the street parking around the area?
Well, I believe that there would be. Currently, when we have special events there, there's plenty of parking all the way around the park as well as perpendicular at 16th Street Park. We have plenty of street parking and parking lot area over there.
Okay.
So it and we have lots of residential areas as well, but we've never had issues of impacts of parking when we have events at that
okay, good.
At that park.
Thank you.
Okay.
And I had a couple. So the money that's budgeted now will cover, you know, the ADA and the sidewalk issues. So anything else we're considering tonight, we would have to find that in the budget or schedule that for the future. Is that correct? Okay. And then I know you were saying there would be maybe a $45,000 spend just to get the basin open, and a much greater spend if you wanted to have it for not a professional soccer league, but a real soccer league. But there was one complaint that I heard in the surveys, and I've heard this from a lot of other people, I saw it in the surveys, was that kids are playing soccer on the tennis court. Would it be allowed to put soccer goals in the basin, even if we just had it at the normal standard, just for people to use?
Generally speaking, the leagues and even just drop-in families are actually bringing their own goals. They have portable goals. So that would be another item for us to have to maintain in the future, and it would be a maintenance issue and when the water is inside. So
okay.
We probably wouldn't recommend that.
Okay. And then I was just seeing if I had if there were questions or comments. No, I think I'll have comments. Thank you.
Okay. So let me tag onto that. So, Mr. City Engineer, so soccer goals or anything else in the basin, would that affect the storage capacity? I know this is one of our obviously major drainage facilities. Just kind of was kind of curious on that.
So it obviously would depend on this on the scope of the facilities that you intended to install. But I mean, a simple soccer net at the end of the field is not going to take much capacity, I don't think. There's no prescribed capacity for the basin. I say that today. However, we're sort of moving toward memorializing the capacity of that basin and creating a city. A stormwater plan for the city that would utilize that basin as part of a citywide solution for stormwater. That sounds kind of reversed. It's already a citywide solution for stormwater, but we're looking at it as a component of our stormwater requirements with the regional board. And so we will be memorializing some volume of that basin, but I'm not real concerned with, you know, minor improvements affecting the volume.
Okay.
So just one question I had. You obviously represented the cost that it would be to kind of maintain the basin from a passive park standpoint and then also a sports field park standpoint. Do we have a lot of interest in using that as a organized sports field at this point? I know both you and Aaron mentioned, Kathy, was that previously it was used, but it's not used currently. Is there any interest from outside folks to say, hey, if you put this back to a certain condition, we will utilize it?
Absolutely. Field space is in a huge demand. So it would be definitely used for drop-in practices. However, there's a lot of work that would need to be done to bring it up to actual game use. So if it's just a drop-in grass area, then that's about as much as we could, you know, allow. And that's what's happening in our current parks right now. We just have drop-in practices.
The fact that it's lit, it has lights, that's another reason why it'd be a high demand for field use.
Okay. So let me open this up to the public and see if there's any members of the community that would like to speak on this item. And if you can just do me a favor when you finish, can you fill out another blue form for us?
Yes, I will.
Thank you.
Sue Streven, Grover Beach. And my question would be to the Parks Department, whether or not the landscape architecture firm that you're working with is using drought-tolerant plants and what I call city or park-friendly trees, due to the fact that, as you know, the ficus is very damaging, and as I mentioned earlier in the evening, the trees that are currently in the city have the tendency to grow over their root capacity, outgrows the area that they're planted in. So that, I think, as a city and thinking about our taxpayer dollars, that taking into consideration drought-tolerant plants and drought-tolerant landscapes is important. That's my only comment.
Okay, very good.
First off, I'd like to thank Kathy. I think she's done a fantastic job on putting this together, presentation. I think she's went above and beyond as far as I'm concerned. And on the parking situation, I heard a couple people talking about that. And I think the reason that was recommended is because at this time, the way the parking is set up, just pull-in parking, not only does it eliminate the sidewalk, because when the car tires hit the curb, it's sticking in another foot and a half. It leaves you about a foot and a half to go through on the sidewalk. There's not much there. However, the other problem is that seems to be where everybody parks and sleeps at night. I don't have a problem with them parking and sleeping at night. What I have a problem with is they throw their trash completely everywhere, and every morning I walk there, I pick up, not every morning, but a lot of mornings I walk there, I take a plastic bag and I clean trash all the way around and throw it in the trash can. And that's the reason I think the parking situation was brought up. Also, it widens it for, and I think that's a great idea, putting in the little workout stations if you want to go to that extent. The use of the field, if you put permanent goal posts down there and it floods in the wintertime, as everybody knows it, that it will do, it would be a waste of your money. Let them bring their little goal posts or whatever they want. As far as capacity, I've been there. I've owned that house since 1983. I've seen it go almost over the backside one time, and it didn't make it then. So I think the capacity is there. I really loved Barbara's idea of the little dog trials things. That's really popular. That could be set up and removed without a problem, I think. As far as getting it ready for league play, I don't know that you'd want to do that, because especially with it flooding every year. It really creates a problem. It's just, I don't think it would be good for league play. Only practice, only like she said. That's what I think on that one. Now on the parking, if you do decide to leave it pull-in parking, I think the city should make it, and this will eliminate some of the problem, permit parking only. A lot of cities, their parks after 10 o'clock are permit parking only. That will eliminate people sleeping there. I know that you have to allow them to have a place to sleep because of the fact that we don't have a shelter. So they get a place to sleep. But if it's permit parking, then they're violating the law. Okay? Then they can be cited and it's legal. There's not an issue there if you decide to leave it pull-in parking. Plus it eliminates, if I pull in my BMW and you pull in your little deal, we can make this drug trade and we'll switch monies and we'll switch drugs, and I see that happening there. So it'll eliminate that because they can't pull in and park beside each other anymore. They have to pull in and park, get out of their car to go to their exchange. On your benches over there where she's talking about, I'll volunteer my time if the city will pay for the material, and I'll rebuild all the benches for you over there. That's an easy thing. If you want to spend some money and get some good wood, I'll use really good wood. Whatever you want. I thank you for your time. I didn't congratulate you. I congratulate the re-elections, but also to elected as mayor. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Wayne. I see someone riding frantically trying to make it.
Hi, my name's Robert Patterson. And when this gentleman mentioned the building of benches, it forced me to have to get up and talk. When I look at this project, I think of all of the years of Boy Scout projects that I've seen, of building benches, of bringing the youth and connecting them directly to the community, so that later on you don't have vandalism going on to your areas, because young men own that project. And there's about 100 hours of volunteer hours that go into every Eagle Scout project. So they're bringing in the younger kids that are 12 and up to help with that Eagle Scout project to build benches. And when you go around, you'll find what they mentioned of the sports set up have actually been done by Eagle Scouts. And the kids are looking for projects like this. The other thing that I see is, I see many times if you go to a hardware store, if you go to a barber shop, if you go to the grocery store, they sponsor a sports team very proudly. They'll put up the photographs, and they're connected. Again, it's a community connection between the community, the youth, and the businesses. And that's, you know, if you guys just build something and we don't think about, you know, how to connect it to the community, it's a different experience than when we connect the community directly. So I just wanted to mention that.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Patterson. All right. Seeing no one come forward, I'm going to close it and bring it back to the council. And just want to commend staff for a good staff report and bringing forth these items. And obviously, you've taken this before the Park and Recs Commission. So looks like there's several things in front of this council tonight. You're looking for some direction with respect to moving forward with, I would characterize this as phase one. This is what you're presenting tonight. Looking at maybe some feedback. I know that you got some, did a community survey, but is there a way to, I guess basically it's the investment in the base and trying to figure out how do we get more community and make this a more useful park, getting more eyes on the park, eyes on the street. So I think we'll have to talk about that. The issue of the parking, either when you talk about, do we say there's no overnight parking and increase patrolling to make sure that that's addressed, because that seems to me like a short-term issue. But obviously you're going to have to discuss whether you leave the parking there or it's a different fashion. I do have a question, though. So all the focus has been on South 14th. Has there been any discussion about South 16th Street? Because South 16th Street is, in fact, and then the next series of streets to be improved. Are there and maybe we can talk about, are there opportunities to narrow the width of the street to get some of the wider sidewalks in some of these streets we're talking about, as opposed to eliminating parking? So,
yes, that certainly is an opportunity to look at. Like you said, South 16th will be the next project under design, so that could be considered then.
Okay. So let me see where the council is on the – so maybe just – I don't know if you have something that lays out the first phase. Is that there was the sports area, the, I think, Basin and Carolyn House, right, improvements?
So as that slide's coming up, perhaps a question that came to mind during the discussion was the plans that have been prepared by Firma. Where would you characterize those on the level of a master plan for this park? So because it, I mean, almost feels as if as we start to discuss phasing of improvements, is there a master plan type of concept for the park that would allow staff and future councils to be able to budget appropriately towards these improvements and allow the community to see the plan and the strategy for which level of improvements come first. So where on a master planning scale would you consider the plans that have currently been prepared?
I would consider this as phase one. If you consider that health and safety and repairing and the sports courts area, though, that is being upgraded, repaired. Phase two would be the basin. Phase three would be the parking.
And just to add to that, when we began this and programmed it as a project, I think we were focusing a little bit more narrowly on the hardscape improvements, the walkways, the tables, given some immediate concerns there. But as the discussion went on and the surveys came back from residents and the commission, there was interest in broadening this to include the basin, to include the parking, to include some master planning elements that perhaps weren't originally programmed as part of this project. So I think we may be backing into a master plan-like approach. I guess the question for the council is, do you wish to create a broader master plan explicitly for this park, given these interests that you're hearing from the community, from the commission, and that the council is expressing as well? We can approach any number of different ways just to make sure we're meeting the interests that the council wants us to meet.
And I think, as just under kind of discussion, I think there's a happy medium there somewhere, because I think the community and the discussion that's come forward from the surveys is a cleanup of the basin is a highly desirable first effect. And whether it's an adopt-a-park type of program to where we use the funding that we have in place and kind of bring the community into participation for that first phase, and then engage some of the community organizations, whether it's Boy Scouts, like Mr. Patterson mentioned, or Five Cities Rotary or Five Cities Men's Club or some other organizations that have done projects in the city, to where we can partner and make the life safety improvements as part of those, engage Boy Scouts, Eagle Scouts, and an adopt-a-program to kind of fully encompass those improvements as we're developing the longer-term strategy of parking on Trouville, narrowing of 16th Street, and the possibility of improvements for the sports track, and then longer-term improvements of use of the basin by sports teams, which may need an additional funding source in order to maintain that ongoing maintenance.
Okay. Anyone else?
So it all looks good. You know, the first phase, it just sounds like stuff that just has to be done. And unfortunately, it sounds like that's what we can afford right now, barely. Wow. But I do like the way you've laid out the phases, because in my mind, getting that basin open as soon as possible, you know, people are talking about feeling unsafe in the park and the park being deserted. Majority of it's locked up. So I just want to get the gates back open. People would love to use that field. So as soon as possible. And I really do agree with the comments about the parking, changing the parking, because when people mention feeling unsafe, like, I walk laps around there, and there are some weird things always kind of going on that parking lot. You don't really know what's going on. And it is very frustrating when you're a person who walks or runs laps, because when you get to that side, there's really no good way to do it. You're walking over parking medians. I know I'm usually the advocate for things for children, and I know people did mention playground equipment, but there's already playground equipment at 16th Street Park, and I almost see this park as maybe being like a more adult focused park, where you really make a nice walking track that tells you your mileage, so you know, okay, I've done a quarter mile or mile, and maybe you do have the exercise equipment. And I would love, I told Matt this, I said don't freak out, but you know how we do the concerts on Sundays? You know, what if on Friday nights we show movies in that basin, if we could get there by this summer? And instead of it always being kid-focused, like old movies that adults would like, and like sell wine.
What do you mean old movies?
Well, like, you know, well, because anything now is rated R.
What?
Anything now is rated R. So you go for the old
like
movies
the love
that
bug
are PG.
Or?
Yeah, like things like that. But so I just think reactivating it means getting the gate open and letting people in there. I think they'll have their dogs, and it would be great. The sooner, the better.
So how about this? I mean, I think there's a lot of great ideas, and a lot of us were talking about implementation. I think when we did Ramona, there was a master plan. We talked about we're going to upgrade the building, we're going to do this, the restrooms, and then ultimately the new play equipment. So I think, you know, perhaps this the council should give direction that, okay, so let's move forward on phase one. So apparently phase one is this sports area. But I will say that it is the end of November. You all will be having a discussion on goal setting early next year. I'll say it again. It's the public's money. It is not this council's money. It is all of our money. So if this is how the community wants to spend their money, if they want to rejuvenate this basin, then have that conversation. Sounds like we've got money budgeted to at least do the first phase. Let's move forward to show some action. And then I think if the council majority is in support of giving staff the green light to come up with a master plan, let's broaden the scope of that. Let's look at on South 16th Street, if you, quite honestly, if we're going to fix the street, if you can bulb out the street there, maybe that's a traffic calming measure that presents opportunities for walking and things of that nature. But I think that's a discussion that needs to be had. And I would even go a step further to say, you need to provide a connection from this basin to 16th Street Park, because there are some sidewalks over there on the Mentone side that when we were out doing the cleanup. And Sue, I want to say when we were out doing the Grover Beach cleanup, I think one of my jobs was to pick up all the cigarette butts out of the gutter. So I'm with you on that. Oh, trust me. But anyway, so I think if staff, if that's the count, if the council's okay with that, giving them direction to come back with more of a master plan, that, you know, because, you know, I've said it, and I'm going to say this to my last meeting in this council, can't be afraid to think big. You can't be afraid to lay this out, because you may have resources just in our general fund, but who knows? There may be state funds or other funds, and this is how we did this out the west end of Grand Avenue. We put together a master plan, and funds became available, and we were able to move quicker as opposed to doing this thing in an ad hoc piecemeal fashion. So I think there's an opportunity. I think the community has asked for this, and so I would certainly advocate for that myself.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like we have a consensus to give staff that direction. So move forward with phase one and then come back, I guess, put together a master plan that incorporates all the things that were discussed here tonight. And then I think there may be an opportunity to talk about what other potential uses in the basin. You know, I think Barbara brought up one. I know I had people come to me and talk about frisbee golf. I know I used to go in the basin and actually practice my golf. what a sand wedge, not a driver. So I think we've got a consensus. We good?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. How's everybody feeling? Good? Should we keep moving? All right. So we're going to go back up to item number 13. This is an introduction and first reading of an ordinance to repeal and add a new section 3.50 of Chapter 3 of Article 9 of the Grover Beach Municipal Code, parking regulations and related sections, and approve a local coastal program amendment, development application 1846. And we will give Mr. Buckingham an opportunity to get set up.
Good evening, Mayor and members of the council. I'm going to start out by just giving a brief background and overview, and I'm going to turn this over to our consulting team. First, just want to start out by saying, as the council knows, the update of the city's parking regulations has been a long-standing goal of the city council. It is currently part of your development review goals for this year. The last significant update to our parking regulations was in 1996, so it's about time to update them, and certainly since then there have been a lot of changes in parking demand and best practices in formulating parking regulations. So staff went about this a little bit differently for this ordinance update. We recognized, as did the council through budgeting, that there was a need for technical expertise to bring in somebody that had information on current parking demands, experience in preparing parking studies, as well as current best practices. And the city ended up hiring a consultant team, two firms, TJKM Transportation Consultants and Lisa Wise Consulting. TJKM specializes in all aspects of transportation planning. They have an extensive experience and knowledge of parking demand. And Chris Kinzel in the front row is here tonight to address any technical questions that the council would have. In addition, Lisa Wise Consulting, you're very familiar with them. They've expertise in writing ordinances. They've assisted, they were the did the West Grand Avenue Master Plan. They've also previously updated one of our housing elements, and they were also intricate in updating our development code in 2012. So lots of experience. Martha Miller next to me is here tonight, and I'm going to turn it over to her to give the council an overview or summary of the parking ordinance.
Thank you, Mayor, and members of the council. Martha Miller with Lisa Wise Consulting. So I'm going to go through a relatively quick introduction to the project, an overview of what's included in your packet, the proposed parking regulations, and then leave it open for your discussion. So as Bruce indicated, the update to the parking regulations is really in order to bring them in to implement general plan policies and the vision of the West Grand Avenue Master Plan. Also reflect changes in parking demand and best practices for regulating parking in a way that is relevant in response to Grover Beach's unique situation. Provide flexibility for providing that parking and meeting parking demand and promoting high quality parking area design. So the revisions really focus around three main topics. One, the first being usability. So the revisions had to do with clarifying the applicability of parking requirements, particularly for additions and alterations when you have already existing uses or existing buildings. The second is consolidation of parking standards. So wherever possible, we moved parking standards that were throughout your code into one chapter. So there's a one place to look for those. Also, simplification of parking metrics. So parking standards were based on fixed standards, such as floor area versus things like students or employees, so something that's actually measurable. The second kind of highlight of revisions were changes to minimum parking requirements. And first, there was kind of a reduction in standardization of parking requirements. So they're adjusted to reflect actual need and the parking analysis that TJKM did on parking utilization and parking availability. At the same time, also trying to standardize parking requirements among uses. So similar uses have similar parking requirements. And that's really for economic development so that there's flexibility and there can be change of use without always having to recalculate parking requirements or try to find new parking in some cases. Another change was allowing on-street parking to count towards required parking in some cases. Allowances for parking reductions for specific nature of either a location of a lot or the type of development, transit accessibility, car sharing programs, and I'll go over those a little bit more. And then also parking districts, so not establishing any parking districts. That would happen through study and council action, but providing the ordinance provision, the enabling ordinance for that to happen. The third group of revisions really have to do with design and configuration, and those revisions tended to focus on articulating the allowances for tandem and valet parking, where that's appropriate and how that needs to be provided, as well as additional allowances for off-site parking. So the first section of the parking regulations really is applicability. So when do requirements apply? And it's easy with new buildings and new uses. You need to provide parking in consistent with the parking requirements. Then we articulated when you needed to provide parking for additions. So for non-residential, it's for additions that increase square footage by 10% or more. You need to provide parking for that addition. And in residential development, additions that increase square footage by 500 square feet or more. We also revised the change in use. So your current ordinance has an allowance that in your commercial visitor serving and your commercial business zones, you don't need to provide additional parking for reuse of existing buildings. And that's really to allow for the reuse of buildings that are built currently with little or no parking. So this was expanded to incorporate the central business open zone. So in effect, essentially all properties on West Grand from Highway 1 to 14th Street is allowed this exemption. The second group of changes is about the parking regulations. So again, One of the first things we did throughout was try to standardize the parking requirements by land use. So wherever possible, so for grouping them. So service uses would require one space per 300 square feet, and that's for a whole group of service type uses. Sites with multiple uses need to provide parking equal to the sum of the parking required for each individual use. And then on-street parking can be counted towards your required parking for certain uses in your kind of visitor serving your active commercial zones. For the required number of spaces, there's revisions to the requirements for residential uses, which in your staff report, there's a table that really compares the existing to the proposed. So there's a lot of kind of changes that happened or revisions, but essentially what's proposed is that for single family, required to have two garage spaces per unit. For multifamily, it varies by the size of unit. So recognizing that studio and one bedroom apartments would tend to have a lower parking demand than larger bedroom units. In the draft ordinance, we did include a lower parking requirement for two or more bedroom units for extremely low, very low, and low-income household affordable housing units in zones. And this was something that the Planning Commission discussed and did not recommend. They recommended that they provide the same amount as parking as market rate units. And then planned unit development, two garage spaces per unit. Guest parking was a conversation we had with the Planning Commission regarding planned unit developments, and their recommendation was really, you know, on some planned unit development properties that area there on a corner where people can park in an individual driveway, that really acts as your guest parking, and they don't need to provide extra guest parking. So that was a way to reduce the amount of space that needed to be dedicated to parking by allowing those planned unit developments to not have to provide additional guest parking. Overall, for multifamily and planned unit development in general, there is a reduction in the required guest parking spaces. The commercial uses, again, the standard requirement, one per 300 square feet of floor area, which is a general reduction. So like all different uses had all different requirements. So in general, this is a reduction across the board. There is a difference for standalone restaurants, because restaurants tend to have a higher parking demand than retail type uses. So those do have a higher parking requirement. And when in a multi-tenant center, when there's more than 50% of those uses are restaurants, there's a higher parking requirement. But if there's a couple restaurants in a larger retail-oriented multi-tenant center, that could be just parked at the 1 per 300, again, to allow for that change in tenancy and change of uses that happen. For industrial uses, there is a standard requirement of one space per 750 square feet. That reduces the requirement in some cases and increases it in others. So for manufacturing uses, it's reduced, but for warehousing, it's increased. But we think in balance, it kind of balances out at the end of the day, because there's usually some combination of both of those types uses in any operation. And then finally, articulating for accessory uses that, you know, if up to 10%, you're just included in the parking requirement for that primary use. If you occupy more than 10%, you're kind of recognized as a kind of a separate use, and we look at your parking for that particular use. Bicycle parking is required according to the building code, and one of the reasons that this just includes that cross-reference there is the building code, it tends to change over time as far as how many spaces are required, and just to keep from coming back and always updating the development code to be consistent, we refer to the development code. So the parking space is based on the total number of parking spaces, and then the applicant or the developer, the property owner, provides that. The next section is a series of provisions that allow for the reduction of parking requirements. Those include motorcycle parking, so you can provide motorcycle parking instead of vehicle parking for a certain percent, and up to 10% parking reduction for if you're located near transit, or if you offer a car sharing program. And then finally, the director could allow additional reductions, or there's a process through the administrative use permit approval where you could request additional reductions, and then you make the case for that. The next section is on the location of required parking. So parking may not be located within required setbacks. There's some allowance for adjustment there, but that's consistent with your existing provisions. But then off-site parking is allowed, and the difference with this is that that's now allowed for residential uses, and then the distance allowance for non-residential has been increased, I believe, from 300 to 500. I touched on the parking districts. Again, the allowance for it, but there's no parking districts created. That would be through a separate study and through a separate community process. A new section for loading spaces, and this establishes kind of the base requirements for the space, location, size, and dimension. The director has the ability to, through review of the actual use, to either lower it if that nature of the use warrants, or increase that if there seems to be a need for additional loading spaces. But this at least gives a base for what's required. And then finally, the parking design and driveway standards, really incorporating the standards that you use or currently, the city standards and specifications, providing the dimensions for parking spaces, maneuvering aisles, and then as well as parking, paving, drainage, lighting, landscaping, all those design features that go into parking areas. So just to touch on some of the conversation that we had with the Planning Commission when we went and they looked at this, I mentioned that they wanted to, or felt it was appropriate to increase the parking requirements for affordable units with two or more bedrooms to two spaces, so treat them the same as market rate units. Eliminate the requirement for PUD guest parking on corner lots where guests can park in the driveway. We reflect that regulation or that recommendation kind of written in a different way, but getting to that same intent. So if you have driveway space that can accommodate a car and it's your private driveway in front of your private garage, that can count as your guest parking, and you don't need to provide additional. We clarified the minimum driveway widths for planned unit development and multifamily residential projects. The existing, what we had in there kind of treated them different, even though the nature of them was the same. There's just a different ownership in it. So we cleaned that up so that they're consistent with each other. And then the Planning Commission wanted to incentivize EV charging stations by allowing a parking reduction or reducing building fees or promoting grants. So some of that is separate from would be separate from this effort, and we had not incorporated a parking reduction for EV charging stations in the draft. So that was not included.
So with that, I just wanted to provide one final comment to the council. Overall, there are some, I'll say, minor changes in a lot of the parking requirements, usually slightly to the reduction. But the one thing to emphasize is, whether it's the land use element, the Grand Avenue Master Plan, all talks about really the focus of trying to redevelop properties on Grand Avenue. And that's basically from Highway 1 to 14th. The reason we say that is from 14th to Oak Park, it's a retail commercial zone. It's very more suburban laid out, and that hasn't really been the focus of incentivizing redevelopment. But between clarifying and updating the standards for mixed-use development, allowing this on-street credit calculation, if you will, reducing guest parking, all of those things in combination will reduce parking for potential new mixed-use developments on Grand Avenue. And again, by providing that incentive, that hopefully goes towards meeting the council goal of getting more redevelopment and new infill projects on Grand Avenue. So just wanted to mention that. In closing, the recommendation from staff is to adopt the resolution certifying the neg deck that was prepared for the project, which identified no significant environmental impacts for the project. tonight to conduct first reading by title only, introduce the ordinance amending the parking regulations, and then finally scheduling the second reading for the next meeting, as well as adopting the local coastal program amendment resolution. This does need to go to the Coastal Commission for final approval. So that concludes the staff presentation, and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, nice staff report. Let's see if there's who's got questions.
I just have one.
Okay, Mary, why don't you go, and then we'll go to Dave.
I had a question. I noticed in here none of these requirements meet the density bonus for development. And as someone who's not a planner or developer, but whenever I am in those circles and we're trying to think about low-income housing, whenever people hear density bonus, their eyes light up. So none of the new standards will qualify for those, but will that be something you could come and petition your project for an exception?
Yes. In fact, okay. The state says you can preempt local regulations and apply for the state density bonus. The purpose of that chart was just to kind of show you, too, where we are today, that this would reduce the parking, but it's still not going to be quite as low as the state density bonus. And in some ways, that may be the best approach, because that way you're still providing an incentive to a developer to say, hey, I want to take the state density bonus. I want to reduce my parking. But in return, then you are going to get required affordable housing as part of that.
All right. Thank you.
Debbie?
I'm wondering if you consulted with any of the businesses or the Chamber of Commerce on any of this.
We certainly have noticed them, and especially for the council meeting, we probably reached out to the chamber, and I want to say randomly we selected probably 10 or 12 developers that either do a lot of projects in the city or have projects in the process right now. And certainly anecdotally, as we've been talking to them, they are well aware of this. And I would say, for the most part, because these are benign or actually incentivized, we had not received any concerns or negative feedback.
Okay, thank you. And so I've had several comments from folks around the 3rd and Grand area, because it is highly restaurant intensive, and or has become so. And for instance, even at 3 o'clock this afternoon, it was difficult to find parking at Red B. And I noticed that no study was done from 8 to 10 a.m., which is high season for coffee. So I just wondered if there had been any thought around that. And also, I've had a lot of complaints from businesses in the little strip mall between 11th and 12th. And I've checked it out, and there have been times when I haven't been able to go into businesses there, and I've just driven past because there's nowhere to park on Grand or in the parking lot. And so I'm just wondering if there's any thought gone into. I know that it says that we don't have a problem, but in reality, people are having problems.
Well, certainly Chris Kinzel with TJKM could address the, why choose a parking supply study in February versus Labor Day weekend. Mm-hmm. But it does go to the point that as we continue to redevelop on Grand Avenue and get an improved mixture of businesses, we are going to attract more people. And this kind of goes to something that we mentioned in the staff report. It's not having a parking problem is kind of an issue, because you're not attracting people, and yet having a parking problem means you are attracting people. And, the overall council goal certainly is to transition to more of a pedestrian-oriented Grand Avenue. And part of the consequences of that is simply you may have to park further down the street and then have to walk, but that there's a benefit of walking by other businesses. And on the other hand, I'll just say, on some of these, smaller strip centers, you have a property owner, and ultimately, they can control who their tenants are as well. If they feel like there's a parking issue, they may not want to rent to somebody that might have higher parking demand. But certainly, this does leave that more to the business person or property owner's decision and what they want to. The mix of businesses they want to have in their center. And something that we didn't have previously was, as Martha mentioned, hey, when you get to more than 50% of restaurants in a center, well, now you need to provide more parking. And quite frankly, most of these centers aren't going to be able to provide more parking. So it's going to set a cap in those multi-tenant commercial centers.
Okay. And then it does reference several things, such as what it references the RV parking code. And that's another thing that I've had a lot of questions and conversation around. What is the RV parking code?
It wasn't within the scope of this this particular ordinance update. This is just a remainder from, quite frankly, the current parking regulations, mm-hmm. where if someone was looking through this and for some reason they were really looking for RV parking in residential zones, this gives them the reference to the municipal code section that has that. In general, it's, if I can quote, if you're 22 feet vehicle or less, you can park it in your driveway. If it's greater than 22 feet, then it is supposed to be in a side or a rear yard and screened by a fence.
And what about on the street? Is that?
Currently, only the 72-hour parking requirement applies to that.
Okay.
And in January, we'll be talking about code enforcement issues, and we will be talking about that one at that time.
Good. Good. I'm sure people will be glad to hear that. Or not. And then vacation rentals, that's another thing I'm hearing a lot about. It increases parking in neighborhoods. And so I guess my question would be, what section would a vacation rental come under?
That will come under the vacation rental ordinance when we get to it, because currently they are not regulated.
Good answer. Yes.
Okay. All righty. And then going back to outside references, there's a reference to lighting complying with outdoor lighting, and that's another thing we hear a lot about is safety and lighting. And so I'm wondering what the parking lot lighting reg actually really says.
I can give you a second and look that up. But remember, this certainly would not address public lighting in the public right-of-way. That would be the city. In essence, I can't remember if we cite a lumens, but a minimum amount of lumens. I think that's actually in the building code. But the lighting section is more to, we don't want extra tall standards that create, I'll say, light pollution. We want them at the height of the building or less. And in general, we'll provide overall lighting that's adequate for safety.
Okay. Thank you. That's all for now.
Okay. Let me move to my right. Barbara, you have anything? Any questions?
No, I don't.
Jeff?
Very, very well orchestrated presentation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll compliment the presentation as well. Just had a couple questions, one of which is probably a higher-level parking question. So as you were reviewing the existing parking, so it looked like you were kind of capturing the public parking component, not necessarily the private parking component. Did I misunderstand that as I was reading it, or were you kind of looking at both components? In other words, are we obviously the discussion was being able to utilize the on-site street parking in for private development. So, are we underparked for our developments, or are we overparked for our developments, which leads to the need for the on-street parking for redevelopment purposes?
So I'll start by saying that, first of all, the parking ordinance really only addresses private on-site parking. It doesn't address street parking. What the study that TJKM did about just looking at the inventory of spaces on the street and in a few of the major parking lots, either city-owned or privately owned, just trying to get a sense of where are we with parking demand today. And so what it determined was there are certainly sometimes during the day where we do have excess parking, maybe not every hour of the day. So really only addressing this ordinance on site. The unique part of it was, again, really back to the incentive, and this only applies to the commercial zones on Grand Avenue from Highway 1 to 14th, and that is we do take, as proposed, you are going to just take a simple linear footage calculation of your frontage. If you have 88 feet divided by 22, you get to reduce your on-site parking requirement by 4 spaces. That doesn't guarantee that somebody's going to be able to park in those 4 spaces in your frontage. It's just simply an incentive to reduce the parking and recognizing that there can be parking on surrounding public streets.
Which actually leads to a great introduction for my next question with regards to the on-street parking. So if there is a ability to capture or reduce your on-site parking by four, this is not generating a decision to go towards assigned parking in the street for private uses. I didn't read that. I just want to make sure that was not the
none
intent
whatsoever
of the discussion. Okay. So then I think the last question I had surrounded the discussion at the Planning Commission with regards to the extremely low housing and the discussion to not make the recommendation to reduce the parking standards. So I didn't see a discussion as to what other jurisdictions are doing with respect to that, notwithstanding what our own Planning Commission might have had the discussion about. Would that be this reduction to 1.5 be consistent with many other jurisdictions, or is that a trend that we may be ahead of?
Well, I'll first just say that I think in recognizing council goal to provide more affordable housing, this was just viewed as a potential incentive. If you're going to reduce the parking slightly, again, that really always leads to less parking on site, means that you have more opportunity to increase density. So you may get more units as a result of that. But I would also say that, you know, we still are in the draft ordinance, there are special conditions, which would also be another way of reducing parking. If people self-help housing came in tomorrow and they could demonstrate in their projects that they only need 1.5 parking spaces, we would look at that. And if it was vetted, we would then the review authority could grant that reduction of parking. So there's still a way to grant a reduction of parking for affordable housing if it can be demonstrated that there is a less demand.
Okay. So then the second part of that question was, are other jurisdictions already utilizing this in their code rather than as an exemption process?
Yeah, so many jurisdictions do. Many jurisdictions also don't. I mean, it's all kind of over the board and tied to each individual jurisdiction. And Bruce characterized the discussion wasn't that they should provide more parking. It was just that there's a lot of tools in this ordinance, and there were tools available to offer the parking reduction, not only through a reduction program, but also through state density bonus. So that this was kind of redundant with other allowances.
Okay. That's all the questions I had, so I'll have comments and discussion.
Okay, very good. So I'm just curious in the discussion regarding Planning Commission requiring additional spaces for affordable units and whatnot. Is that consistent with state law? Does that run afoul of state law? Because I know that we've had to talk about projects where someone comes in and it is defined as an affordable housing project. They are, by state law, allowed fewer parking spaces, one per unit. So I want to make sure that that was a discussion and there was a clarification.
Yeah, and to be specific, right now under the state density bonus, one bedrooms require one space, two bedrooms require two spaces. The as drafted, not the Planning Commission recommendation, it'd be still, again, one space per one bedroom, but instead the city would be saying 1.5 spaces for a two bedroom. So in essence, you'd be having a lower parking requirement than the state density bonus.
Just want to make sure we're not running afoul of state law. All right. So I like the idea of on-street credits. We know that a challenge we've got here in Grover Beach is we've got small lots on the Grand Avenue corridor. Assembling those lots has been a challenge. So any opportunity to try and incentivize and convince folks to invest sounds great. I guess I was originally thinking, I know the city of Santa Maria allows this in their original 4 square mile or 4 block area that was the original part of the city. So I was just curious as to why Highway 1 to 14th Street rather than 6th to 11th, which we typically say is the downtown. So just want to kind of get a sense of the thought process.
I think it was where would we like to see redevelopment the most? And certainly, while the coastal visitor serving zone from Highway 1 to 5th is certainly a focal point, there are redevelopment opportunities there. And then, as you're saying, the downtown core, again, technically the central business zone is 8th to 11th, and then we have the central business open that surrounds that from 6th to 11th and 11th to 14th. And just to remind the council, what's unique about that CBO zone and is that we could allow an all-residential development. So you really are trying to create nodes in your visitor serving and your CB 8th to 11th. We'll see what happens in those 5th to 8th and 8th to 11th to 14th in the CBO zone. Okay. So, again, I think certainly a council prerogative to make any adjustments there, but I think we would say that all of those blocks are eligible for redevelopment, and this incentive would apply to any of those.
So in that discussion, was there ever the thought of you would try to couple this with, and I appreciate putting in the framework to form parking districts. We've been having this conversation for many years. I know that there was a surprise to many of us, a parking district at Ramona Square, which I think the previous council said we're going to let that one lapse. So I'm just kind of curious if the thought process was, hey, let's allow credit for on-street parking because we need to plan for parking districts and strategic locations. I know we can talk about Ramona Center. We can talk about the surplus lot behind Rabobank, maybe something on the south side of Grand between, let's say, 8th and 5th. I'm just kind of curious, was there any thought process to, if we allow credit with the plan, that eventually there would be public parking in within 1,000 feet or 600 feet?
I think at this point they were mutually exclusive. The first thing right now is to try to create an incentive, and then obviously as parking demand increases on the street, that's when the council would be more likely to talk about parking districts and actually acquiring property and developing surface parking.
Okay. And then my final question is, talk to me about this requiring additional parking when someone adds 500 square feet to a residence, because I do worry that if we're talking about doing that and someone's adding on to a home but they're not increasing the number of people or the parking requirement, so I don't want us to be arbitrary in doing things that will have a counter effect.
Actually, when probably goes back to the 2012 development code, we didn't have any exemption for this. And what we had, so this is really a carryover from the existing code. Mm-hmm. I can give you the history, was that we have, of course, a lot of smaller housing stock in the city and a lot of one-car garages. And we had a couple of people that really wanted to do additions with their one-car garage, and we were saying, no, you need to have a two-car garage. So, yes, admittedly, at the time, we adopted a somewhat arbitrary number of up to 500 square feet, but that was certainly allowing people to invest in their homes to a certain extent without having to add that more parking. Okay. Then over 500 square feet, we say still minor changes can be made. And the example is sometimes people have a two-car garage, but it's older and it's 18 by 20. Well, this gave me the flexibility to say, that's a two-car garage. You're okay. You don't need to meet the 20 by 20 standard today. So we purposely, again, tried to incentivize redevelopment of our residential stock without creating what becomes typically a little bit overburdening, and that's you got to build a two-car garage.
Okay. And then I have to admit, I did have one other question regarding the requirement for loading spaces. That kind of seemed a bit interesting to me. So maybe explain the rationale. Wouldn't we got these small lots and challenges to develop these properties?
Yeah. Real simple. There are no loading standards today whatsoever. And for the most part, they're not applicable for our infill development. A year ago, we had a major drugstore looking at 4th and Grand, and then the issue for a use like that, loading came up. And so this was a response of better to put something in here so that a larger business that really needs to accommodate it does have a standard. But I think, as we acknowledge, as Martha mentioned, for the most part, it's not applicable, and it gives the director the ability to say, this isn't necessary for this type of project.
Fair enough. Thank you for that. All right. Let me open this up to the public and see if there's anyone from the community that would like to address this item before the council. I see no one coming. Sure. Okay. No one coming forward. Let me close it, bring it back to the council. Let's have some discussion. Mayor Pro Tem, do you want to lead?
Sure.
Off?
I'd be happy to. I very much like the format and the revisions that have been changed, and I'm predominantly in support of the changes. I I think the main point of discussion I'd like to have is going back towards the 1.5 spaces for the extremely low or very low conversation. I'd be supportive of putting that back in. I think I see where the Planning Commission was going, but I think in terms of incentivizing some additional affordable housing and density and so forth, I think I'd like to have that be included here rather than a step by development community to go to the director and request that. I think it'd be better to have it up front and in the code from the onset.
Okay.
So, and notwithstanding the discussion about additional statewide bonuses, but I think I'd like it to be in there first. And I'm also supportive of the direction of the on-street parking acknowledgement that we do have the on-street parking, and there can be some parking bonuses or parking density reduction on-site. And then it wasn't specifically mentioned here, but it feels like a somewhat of a change in the fact that parking can now be acknowledged in the front setback as meeting the code requirements versus where I think previously, if I read correctly, it needed to be outside that. So I think that's a good acknowledgement to make sure that the development community and parking improvements can acknowledge that as well, so that there's a more use of on-site space than having driveway, parking, garage type of thing. So overall, I'm supportive of moving forward with staff's recommendation.
I saw Mr. Buckingham move quickly to grab the mic on that about parking in a setback. So can you clarify? Because
currently, of course, most commercial zones don't have a front setback. But I think we previously had a 10-foot minimum landscape area, and so that was kind of restricting parking. We did. That's part of a smaller revision later on, and we did reduce that to 5 feet. So we're still looking on Grand Avenue to have a small area of landscaping to buffer, but it is reduced, and it is allowing now. There is some zones that do have a setback, and so that's providing more flexibility.
And that's just commercial. We're not talking residential, correct?
In residential, the change was in multifamily zones, there's a 10-foot landscape requirement. The setback is 15 feet, so we've allowed a little more flexibility.
Okay, I mean, I'm okay with that, but yeah, to say we're going to park in a setback.
And that's why the 10-foot.
Wrong direction. Yes. Wrong direction.
His characterization was much better than mine.
I know you saw the hair stand up on the back of my neck. I was sitting there going, the city's going to be a parking lot, and people won't be happy about it. So thanks for that. Asking that question, thanks for that clarification. Barbara, you have any comments?
It was quite a challenge getting through this. when we took on this job, I didn't realize that we'd have to do wastewater and traffic and parking and cannabis, etc. A lot of things to absorb. But I think it's very clear. And I can see the need for the changes that are there, and I approve it.
Okay, very good. Miriam?
Yes, it was a good catch by Jeff. I didn't realize that the Planning Commission's comment had then been adopted into the resolution. I certainly want all the parking standards to be lower. I just think that's will encourage the development, especially the low-income development that we need. And everything I'm reading, I know I can't believe it now, but it says people are really going to give up owning their cars by 2030. So, I can't believe it in my family, but I would love it if it happened. And I know even as other cities are looking at, for example, in SLO, creating a parking garage that they really, really need, they're doing it in a way that it can be repurposed in the future. So I think it's really forward thinking to cut away at these parking standards as much as possible and get some housing that people really need and promote business.
All right. Debbie?
I really appreciated the study. It was thorough and it was clear, and it did something we've been wanting to do for so long, and which is clean it all up and make it more consistent. I did sort of a question, but I noticed that the TJKM team will start on working paper 2, and so I'm just wondering, as a council, why we're adopting an ordinance when there may still be some changes, or am I misinterpreting that? It's kind of the last line of the report under next steps, or the last paragraph of the report under next steps.
He's here. You might as well have him answer a question, huh?
I'm TJKM. I'm Chris Kendall. Nice to be here this evening, Mayor and Council. At the time, that was done several months ago, and that what was going to be the follow-up to that was really incorporated into other parts of the analysis and into the work that was done by Lisa Wise Consulting. So there never was, and at this point, there's no intention that there will be.
Okay, thank you.
The second part.
Thanks.
Thank you.
So we've kind of done it, and yeah, okay. I did want to make just one point about we tend to really focus as a planning commission, and it's because it's the way it comes through, but we focus a lot on development and redevelopment, and I think a huge part of economic development is maximizing what we've got. So any time that we have someone not go to a business because they can't find a place to park, that is an immediate impact on the city's income, not just the income of the business, but the income of the city, because the businesses are pay us a lot. You know, we get a lot of income from them. We depend on them. So I do want to just advocate for us remembering that economic development is not just redevelopment, not just the permitting side, but it really is, a lot of it is working with what we've got and making it pay better. And so I want to make sure that we never make decisions that stop those dollars coming in. And especially when we're talking about the West Grand area, we know we're going to continue to really develop that. And so the Coastal Commission's really big on access. Part of access is being able to park somewhere to access it. And I think that we're going to find that parking will become more and more restricted there. So I just want to remind us to keep in mind what's currently going on and how we support what we've already got. And I'm really encouraged, because even though we've loosened up our standards, and I actually agree with Councilmember Lee that we should, in fact, go back to that 1.5 for affordable housing. But we're still stricter than most cities from the charts. So although we've reduced it, I think our citizens can be happy that we're still paying close attention and we're being careful about it. So I'm really happy with it.
Okay. This is my turn. So I will say there's a lot of things that I like about this, and versus obviously the consolidation of the parking standards for ease and convenience, simplification of the standards definitely helps. I think Jeff, you addressed the issue of required number of spaces. I was curious on this. There was a minimum backup distance that was identified in here. Was that for a commercial? I always worry when we start doing things like that and tying people's hands with respect to a design, because if we're saying minimum distances, you know, who knows, if they were to do a wider parking stall, then they may not have to have that kind of depth. So those are the kind of things that always sends a red flag up for me. I like the parking reductions. I think we had that in the previous ordinance, and I like increasing it to 1,000 feet. I think that is very helpful. I know most parking studies show that people will walk about a quarter of a mile, which is roughly about 1,300 feet to get to a bus stop or a business or whatnot. So I think that is in line where I think standards are now. The on-street parking credit for the commercial corridor, I get it. So I mean, I guess I could support from Highway 1 to 14th. But I do think we have to look at that in tandem with parking districts. So the framework that you've put in here is really good. I would maybe advocate that going forward sooner than later, that there be a discussion about identifying where potential parking districts could be. I mean, I've been in this area for over 30 years, and I don't give away my age, but when I first arrived on the Cal Poly campus and I walked downtown, there was a surface parking lot on Court Street. There was a couple of other surface parking lots, and I know the city of San Luis didn't do this on purpose because I worked for them for 5 years, but it ended up being land banking. So I just think that if we're talking about giving credit and if there's opportunities to identify potential locations, I think we've got Ramona Square, we've got a public lot down behind Station Grill, so maybe look at other locations that where something like that could be implemented. I know that costs money, but hey, you're talking about investing in your downtown commercial core, so I appreciate having a framework in place for us to do that. The distance for off-site parking, I really appreciate that being increased to 500 feet. I was thinking, do you go to 600 feet? Because I'm trying to get a sense of the typical city block. Is that a 300 feet or is it 250? So I'm not gonna make a big issue out of it. I think just increasing it to the 500 feet really helps. I know over the years I've had discussions with business owners and others who've said, hey, if we were able to have off-site parking within a certain distance, that would certainly help us in our investment. So I think there's a lot of good things here. And so I think with that, this is definitely an improvement. Just want to make sure that we are not having parking standards that are more restrictive. We want standards that are more reactive and responsive, because we know how people have historically done parking standards. Everyone grabs a normal one that says commercial is like one space for 250 square feet. We need to be a little more creative, and I think this kind of allows us the tools to do those sort of things. So anyway, enough said. Is someone prepared to make a motion on this item?
I'll go ahead and make a motion that we, in one motion, adopt the resolution certifying the neg deck. Conduct the first reading by title only, introduce the ordinance amending Article 9 of the Grover Beach Municipal Code to amend the city's parking regulations, and 3, schedule a second reading and adoption of the ordinance and a resolution approving a local coastal program amendment at the next regularly scheduled city council meeting.
And is that also with your change to the?
As amended.
Very good.
I'll second that.
Okay,
sorry.
There is a motion and a second. If there's no additional discussion on this motion, let's do a roll call.
Mayor Pro Tem Lee.
Yes.
Councilmember Peterson.
Yes.
Councilmember Nichols.
Yes.
Councilmember Shara.
Yes.
And Mayor Schultz.
Yes. Motion carries 5-0. Again, staff, thank you. And Lisa and her and team, thank you for your work. Lisa, I know they've done great, really good work for the city over the years, so we appreciate it.
Okay. Good catch on the amendment.
There you go. All right, let's move to item number 15. This is a fiscal year 2017-18 year end and fiscal year 2018-19 first quarter financial review. So, Ms. Chapin, you have the floor.
Honorable Mayor and City Council, Gayla Chapman, Administrative Services Director. And tonight we have before you the 2017-18 year end and the fiscal year 18-19 first quarter financial review. And the city's general fund is its primary fund, and it provides for general city services for police, fire, parks and rec, and general administration. And also the tax and general revenues are collected into this fund. And before you, there is the fiscal year 17-18 review of the general fund balances. We ended the year with $2,354,857 in cash, which is down by $465,000 roughly from what was originally projected. And overall, the tax revenues are lower by approximately $220,000. Secured property taxes were down by $107,500.
Sorry, Gayla, if you can please advance the slides.
I thought I did. Oh, it's not entering. I don't know why it's doing it that way. Okay, sorry about that. Overall, the revenues are lower, as I said, by $220,000. The secured property taxes are down by $107,500, which could be an indicator of the slowing of the housing market. Cannabis taxes were lower by $83,600, and that was in part due to a delay in the opening of the cannabis businesses from the original projection date. The remaining $28,900 is due to lower tax revenues from property transfer taxes, which again could be an indicator of a slowing in the housing market, and the state sales tax for the public safety. Miscellaneous income and plan check fees were also higher than anticipated. Expenditures are trending higher by $279,000 roughly. Capital expenditure program costs were higher by $241,000, and the operating costs were higher by almost $38,000. It was basically a full expenditure of our budget for last year. Our ending cash balance, as I said, was approximately $465,000 lower than anticipated. The variance equates to about 2% for the revenues, expenditures, and transfers. The general fund cash ending balance for the year for 2019 is estimated to be $1,733,000, or approximately 15% of the general fund expenditures, which this meets the city's reserve policy and is a little bit lower than the council goal of the 20% policy. And this is based on budgeted revenues and expenditures. Okay. So for our wastewater fund, it is responsible for the maintenance and operation of the wastewater lines within the city. The bills are collected and the funds are forwarded to the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District. We bill for them every year. Okay. So right here we have our financial year-end review for the wastewater fund. The beginning cash or the ending cash balance, we're estimating at $2,460,000. It was a difference of $117,000. And for the wastewater fund, revenues were lower than anticipated. The broadband loan repayment was inadvertently left in as expected revenue. Payments are actually set to begin in fiscal year 20. Expenditures are lower than anticipated due to, in part, a backhoe purchase that was anticipated being made, but the backhoe is on back order and is expected next month. And the cash reserves are anticipated to be 62% of the operating costs. So here is the ending balance for our water fund. Our water fund has an ending cash balance of approximately $325,000. It is a little higher than what was actually anticipated for the year. And I put down lower. The expenditures were actually lower. So we had lower revenues and lower than expected expenditures, so that caused us to have the addition into the fund. The backhoe is also partially out of the water fund and the wastewater fund both. Cash reserves are anticipated to be at about 12% of operating expenses, and fiscal year 20, we will be discussing the financial viability of the water fund during the budget process because there are many capital expenditures that need to be made out of the water fund. Okay. So it's just not functioning properly. Okay, there we go. So for fiscal year 18-19, the first quarter financial review is, again, the city's primary fund is the general fund. Our budget for this year is $11,380,000, and revenues are budgeted at $10,748,000, and we have a use of one-time use of reserves of $631,000. This is odd because this what's showing on my screen is not what's showing up there, so that's why I'm having a problem with this.
You should go sit over there where the city manager is. Let him sit over there so you can see the screen.
I'm sorry. See if I can get this to come up where it should be.
Hey, wait, this one's screening over there.
That's the one I just did.
So if you can just advance the slide to the next one, Gayla, and then just kind of speak to the...
Yeah, I'm trying to do that. It is just not cooperating with me at all.
Well, if you can just then go on with the material.
Yeah, I'm going to go to my notes. And I'm sorry about that. So for the first quarter, when looking at the department's budgets, the non-departmental was over half expended at 50%. That is in part due to items such as the payments to CJPIA for our insurance, and also we have a large payment to the Five Cities Fire Authority during the first quarter of the year. So there are several expenditures that come out in advance, including PERS also. Revenues for the first quarter are being received as anticipated. The cannabis tax revenues are approximately $120,000 for the first quarter. Currently, we have two retailers and one manufacturer. Other permitted businesses are getting ready to come online, and most recently this last week we have one manufacturer that has come online. Our transient occupancy tax appears to be slightly higher by about $13,000, higher than what I would have anticipated for the first quarter. So that's good news for our hoteliers. For the wastewater fund and the water fund, both revenues are proceeding as anticipated. The wastewater fund expenditures are proceeding as anticipated, with the water fund expenditures having a higher than anticipated electrical costs, and we're keeping an eye on that. Water fund is also projected to have an ending cash balance this year of only $112,000. So for the upcoming budget process, staff plans to update the 10-year financial forecast utilizing Bill Statler. This will be beneficial in identifying key revenue and expenditure trends, particularly in cannabis, transient occupancy tax, and pension costs. The mid-year report is scheduled for February 4th. Goal-setting workshop is scheduled for late February. A one-year budget is being anticipated for the next year due to staffing transitions, and development of a two-year budget will begin for 2020. And do you have any questions?
Okay. Anyone who's got questions for staff? Now, to my right, Mary?
I have a couple. In the staff report, on page 2, you talk about money expended on the plans for the Grover Beach Lodge mm-hmm. project. And it was saying that these may be reimbursable by the developer. So I guess my question would be, when will they be reimbursed, or kind of what went on with those plans? What was that expenditure all about?
I'll go ahead and answer that question. So this reflects the beachfront improvement project that was initiated in May of 2016. At that time, the project scope included a larger scope than what ultimately is the current site plan for the project. The scope included the public plaza, included the public restroom renovation, included a conference center. As the council is aware, on July 23rd, you did approve a revised site plan that reflects where the project is now, which is focused more on the hotel buildings, parking, landscaping around that, and reserves the other options as future projects down the road. So this portion of the improvement plans that were tied to the hotel are the portion that are reimbursable by the developer, not the entire scope, since that includes scope that's outside of what the current project is today. So that portion, and I don't have the exact number, is reimbursable by the developer. As an other option, and this is a future council decision, the council could have this be used by the developer and then just be incorporated as part of the overall de minimis financial contribution that the city could make to the development down the road. So there are a couple of different options that would be considered at a later date by the council, but that's what we mean by reimbursable. It's on the tab for the specific project that the law is now.
Okay. Thank you. And then the other question was the two new taxes that were just passed, the new TOT rate and the new business tax situation. When might we start being able to see any revenue from that? Like which quarter, or would that be next year?
It would start in the second half of this current fiscal year. Okay. One of the reasons why we wanted to push ahead tonight with the first reading of the two ordinances was to move that process forward quickly. Council will be asked to adopt the ordinances at the next meeting. And I believe, Mr. City Attorney, those would go into effect immediately, would not need the 30-day effective date window that we typically have with ordinances. So we'd start generating the higher TOT revenues effectively immediately, but most likely realistically in January. And then the BTCs, staff is working right now as we speak on updating the process to reflect the new square footage methodology so that the BTC forms going out would be based on this updated methodology now and not the previous one before.
Oh, okay. And was that projected revenue of the new, what I'm assuming that wasn't part of our budget. So is it possible that that may come into play as somewhat of a surplus?
You're correct. We did not assume those revenues in this year's budget to be conservative. So as part of our mid-year budget review and forecast for the next few years, we will be assuming those revenues and that'll be part of the overall revenue outlook that the council will consider.
Okay. And then I just had one other question. Yes. I know we just got an update on kind of how much money the cannabis industry is bringing in, but I asked the city attorney if he would be able to update us on how many jobs have been created by the cannabis industry.
Absolutely. So I have been in touch with the now four businesses that are operating. As Ms. Chapman mentioned, I did deliver the permit last week to Mary's Tech, so they are now operating as well. Of those four businesses, they are now operating with approximately 50 employees.
Wow.
So 50 employees for those four businesses as part of their operations, roughly 30 for the two retailers and then 20 for the two manufacturers.
Wow, that's great. Thank you for that update. Those were all my questions.
Anyone else?
Yeah. Just one question on the one expenditure in non-departmental that's 50.9% because we paid the annual cost of CalPERS unfunded liability. How much was that amount paid? How is that 50.9% made up, I guess, is what I'm really asking since we're way over.
I know there's over $500,000 to CJPIA for workers' comp and liability insurance. There is over $300,000 for Five Cities Fire Authority. There's the CalPERS contribution because it's paid. We get a reduction if we pay it in advance. So we always pay it in July so that we see the reduced cost of that. And I don't recall the exact amount for that.
That's helpful. What I'm trying to determine is, will this come into line?
Yes,
as we move through the year.
Okay. On budget.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, those costs are front loaded in the first part of the fiscal year.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay. So I don't have any questions. Let me see if there's anyone from the public that would have a question on this item. Seeing no one come forward, let me close it and bring it back to the council. And I think with this, is this just a receive and file, city manager?
That's correct. It's really an informational report to the council. And if you have any questions or comments, we'd be glad to take those.
Okay, very good. So we're going to move on. Who's got a council committee report? I'm just, anyone wants to give a report?
I have a bunch.
Oh,
I have
you
just
do.
A small one.
Okay, Debbie, why don't you go first?
Yeah, on the RAC, the Water Regional Advisory Committee, the main thing on that meeting really was just the review of what's happening with our water supplies. And sadly, Lopez Reservoir is significantly lower than it was last year at this time, so we're moving in the wrong direction, which, of course, we could all have perhaps anticipated. And that just means that over the course of the next year, unless we get an incredible rainfall in the next couple of months, we'll be needing to really carefully look at our water use. That's it.
Okay. Jeff?
I have one as well. The Integrated Waste Management Authority did meet last week and did move forward on assigning a contract to a firm out of Glendale, Clifton, Lansing, and Warren, I think it is. I apologize. I don't have the name in front of me, but for the financial audit and the forensic audit for the financial accounting going back years and years to ensure that any investigation review by the district attorney has information and can be brought forward as appropriate. The next item was also a discussion about extending the contract of the interim general manager for an additional 3 months while we continue the process of a search for a permanent general manager for the organization.
Okay, very good. Barbara, you have anything?
No, not on my things. The sanitation district has canceled this week's meeting.
Okay. Miriam, you have
Yeah,
floor.
I have a few. I attended a Zone 3 meeting for Jeff, and just piggybacking on the bad news about the reservoir, the Lopez is basically at that 20,000 mark that would trigger the low reservoir response plan, but they're hoping and just waiting a little bit to see if there's some rain, and also because there are many triggers and steps to implementing that plan, but that could be looming before us. And then we had a very spirited talk about cloud seeding. So that is something that is definitely under consideration and will be brought to the Board of Supervisors. But because the board had looked at it in the past and for various reasons had sent it back to Zone 3 and our experts to look at, we felt that we should meet again to talk about it again, just because the staff really wanted a unanimous vote to put the cloud seeding forward, and people just had various environmental concerns about it, because depending on where you Google, it's the best thing in the world or the most dangerous thing in the world. So people just wanted another report to be sure about it.
I'm sorry. They wanted a unanimous vote.
Yes. The board felt that we should give the Board of Supervisors, it doesn't necessarily have to be unanimous, but just not a very split vote. So they just wanted more. And certain members said they weren't against it. They just wanted more information. So, sorry, I covered that for Jeff, and I got him another meeting. It's going to be November 29th. There'll be a special meeting just to talk about cloud seeding. But this way, it won't delay the process, so that if the Board of Supervisors decides to go forward, there is a tiny possibility this could happen for this rainy season. So they didn't want to delay it. So it's November 29th. Had our last APCD meeting of the year. Got an update on the 2017 air quality report. We approved a new legal counsel because Ray Bering has retired. And just got a usual update from our APCO. The five-year plan to reconfigure the parks is going well, or it's going as expected. No hiccups so far. And I'm the chair next year for APCD, so I'll ring that in January. had several meetings about the South County Homeless Task Force and just trying to get together our best plans and best proposals so we can bring them forward to the Board of Supervisors in the new year and have the best chance of bringing a portion of the $5 million grant funds coming from the state to South County to do some sort of large structure that hopefully makes a dent in this situation. So city manager and I have been to several meetings with several of our different city representatives and chief was there too, and several police officers. So we're all kind of at the same table coming up with the best proposals we can, and the city manager is going to bring this item to us probably in January so we can kind of hear how things are playing out before it goes to the Board of Supervisors. So more to come on that. I had a meeting about the MASH event. I've been in a lot of meetings. Had a meeting with the MASH event that has been held here in South County for the past 2 years. And this year, we are going to actually, instead of having it at the South County Regional Center, because it was just people weren't attending as much, we're going to have it at the Oceano Community Center. And we're going to connect it to back to school. And we're going to have free backpacks and free dinner instead of lunch, and see if that kind of improves people being able to attend and just kind of reach people who are working but still need help and services. So that enables them. And I received this annual report from Visit SoCal, which I will be hearing more about this at the update meeting in December. But if anyone wants to take a look at it, you are more than welcome. And, well, I think that is it.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
One of the committee reports. On the APCD, I get actually two reports every day on air quality, and it goes out on the air quality for a few days, which I find really helpful because I have issues with air quality. But one of the things that they never seem to cover is smoke and problems with air quality due to smoke. And I don't know if it's because their equipment doesn't measure that, but it seems all they tell me about is sand in the air, and I need to know about the smoke too, and I'm sure there are other people who struggle with that air quality issue. So I just wondered if that's something maybe you could take back to them for the rest of the community.
I have gotten some alerts about smoke. You just go to the Air Pollution Control District website, so just Google South County Air Pollution Control District, and you just click on this thing that says AirAware, and when you sign up by email and text, I do get things about blowing sand, but I've gotten things about smoke at different times, but I can ask and make sure.
Yeah, I get a little bit sometimes, and there'll be a blurb at the end of it, but I don't get the warnings, and it seems to be kind of after the fact, and I mean, obviously, you can tell when the air is bad, but it would be helpful to have a little bit of a forecast on it.
I can ask them if they can include more info.
Thanks.
Okay. I don't have any reports tonight. The SLOCOG meeting, there was no SLOCOG meeting in November, but the next one is December 12th. And I know, Mary, you're my alternate, so if you could check your calendar and potentially attend that would be very helpful. Okay. All right. Any council communications?
I have one. I got a notice on Facebook the other day that New Tech High junior class is holding a political forum at the South County Regional Center. I didn't bring this paper, but I think the dates are either next week Thursday on the 29th or Friday on the 30th. And I think this is being hosted by the Chamber of Commerce. It is for them to learn about politics, about civil discourse. I think it's going to be very interesting, and they would very much like any local politicians to attend.
And it is Thursday the 29th, which I was looking so very much forward to attending until Miriam scheduled a meeting for me.
That's so I can go to it.
But hopefully I'll be able to attend afterwards.
Anyone else?
I did have one announcement as well, is the Five Cities Homeless Coalition, in partnership with Finn's Restaurant, will be hosting a Giving Tuesday event next Tuesday, which is the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. And it is November the 27th from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. with 100% of the donations from a dinner with a cause at Finn's Restaurant going towards the services provided by Five Cities Homeless Coalition. Mm-hmm. And the staying on the Five Cities Homeless Coalition update is the warming shelter is potentially open. So the timing is open as of November 1st. However, the discussion is pending either activity of rain, which could be as early as Wednesday, or also the discussion about air temperature and so forth. And there is a fundraising opportunity for that $99 per purchases a cot for someone in need of a place to rest their head for in support of the warming shelter.
Okay, very good. I'm going to allow the city manager to give in his report some of the good news and some other things that are planned in the community. So with that, city manager, what do you have?
Sure. Just a couple of things. I'm glad to respond to other questions as well. In particular, I'd like to recognize that on Saturday, December 8th, we have our inaugural beachfront holiday stroll in Grover Beach. This is an event that the council had asked staff to work on in concert with the chamber and local businesses on West Grand Avenue. And so we're delighted to bring this forward. I want to give shout outs to Jocelyn Brennan of the chamber, to Kathy Petker, to the local business community on West Grand Avenue. The plans are shaping up very nicely for this inaugural event. 3 to 4:30, again, Saturday the 8th, roughly Grand Avenue from 4th Street to 2nd Street. So in that block around Beachfront Place. Right now, we have about 10 businesses who are taking part in this special event. We'll have different activities, special menu items, great decorations. A roving Santa will be walking up and down Grand Avenue. We'll have a raffle prizes and passports to encourage people to come by and check out the businesses, and then raffle prizes at the end once they finish up their passports. So, credit to the council for sparking the idea, and we've worked really hard to bring this together and do this in a way that can be built upon and scaled up in future years. So that's coming up here very soon. It's a great opportunity to highlight our new rope lights on the palm trees and the repainted light poles, the pedestrian light poles on West Grand Avenue as well. And also, I'll just recognize our acting city clerk, who has been here for her first council meeting, Wendy Sims. Credit her and thank her for what she's been doing. This is her first council agenda, and she's done a great job in bringing this forward in a seamless capacity, building on the great training that Donna McMahon provided to her before Donna stepped away last week. With that, I'd be glad to answer any other questions the council may wish to address.
Any information you can share with the council and the community regarding train station expansion and then broadband?
Sure. So with regard to the train station, we're very pleased that the project is on schedule and moving right along. You can go down Highway 1 and see the site coming up before your eyes. The fill is coming up, so you see the whole new platform for our new expansion project. We're very pleased to say that Caltrans has issued the final encroachment permit for the traffic control within the street. We worked diligently with our state partners to bring this to completion, so we now have all the permits from Caltrans that we need to complete this high-priority project. Again, we are on schedule, on budget. We have a great contractor working with us, and we're very pleased to see this project forward.
Anything on broadband?
Oh, sorry, broadband. We are working very closely with our colleagues, our partners at Digital West on this public-private partnership to really expand our economic opportunities. The project is 99.9% complete, and that 0.1% is a critical part. That is the installation of a circuit at the terminus of the network, and that's being done by AT&T. They're working on their schedule. Digital West is pushing them pretty hard. We're trying to get this installed, activated, and announced as quickly as possible. And we will have more information as soon as we get it from Digital West.
And then the last thing is, Ramona, the parking lot and the lot behind the post office, as well as the Trueville Center. I know we we coupled those two for some economies of scale, I think the community would be interested in knowing where we are.
Absolutely. So this project, which also is in the adopted capital program for this year, is moving forward. We did open up bids last Friday. We received four bids for the project, and we are doing some final vetting on the apparent low bidder. We will be bringing this forward to the council on December the 3rd for award of contract to move forward with this project.
Very good. Thank you, City Manager. City Attorney, you have anything tonight?
Nothing this evening.
All right. It looks like we've got a pretty packed closed session tonight. My goodness. So four items. Can you cover those?
I surely may. Thank you, Honorable Mayor. The council is going to convene in closed session on four items. One is conference with labor negotiators pursuant to Government Code Section 54957.6. The agency negotiators are Special Counsel Terry Johnson, City Manager Matthew Bronson, Service Director Gayla Chapman, Assistant Administrative Service Director Eve Burt, and Management Assistant Human Resources Carlin Maddox, along with Accountant Heidi Stuckert. The represented group employees is AIU Service Employees International Union. The second item will be a conference with legal counsel on anticipated litigation. This is based on existing facts and circumstances. The legislative body of the local agencies has decided to initiate or is deciding whether to initiate litigation. And this is pursuant to Government Code 54956.9D4. It represents one potential case. And then there's my employee performance evaluation. Pursuant to Government Code Section 54957, the employee, me, city attorney, and the conference with labor negotiators pursuant to Government Code Section 54957.6, the agency negotiators dissolve the city council, and the unrepresented employee is again me.
Very good. I don't have any speaker request forms on closed session items. Is anyone that would like to address these items before we go into closed session? Seeing no one come forward, yes.
Sir, just one item that the city manager didn't mention that is going to happen before our next regularly scheduled
you're late.
Meeting. I know, I realize that, but our holiday parade is going to happen December 1st.
December 1st.
Our 52nd annual holiday parade, December 1st, which is next week from Saturday. So with Gingerbread Dreams.
I'll allow that.
I appreciate that.
So with that, we are going to recess in a closed session.
Here's your zone.